Yeah, Frank here has got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
Billiard room.
No, not billiard. Not the billiards. It was...
Billiards room.
Come on already. Come on. We call it the...
The place to be.
The place to be. Yes, the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Time to play the game!
Well, you always left me satisfied and smiling, so...
But that's what she said!
Why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to be nations, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Isn't that what I just said? What is wrong with you?
Is it the Pelicans? I didn't know it was the Pelicans.
Oh,
I
you're like,
know nothing
you're like,
about the word Pelicans.
Yes.
I work during the fucking day, okay?
And so then I'm doing this, and then he touches me, and I swear to God, this is going to sound, this is probably one of those you want to pull out the audio for your promo. He touches me with his voodoo stick.
Until you fancy to make a decision, Scott's stuck twisting in the wind, a pawn in your sick, cruel game of vacation domination. I don't know what the fuck the Department of Health is. I think this whole thing's a load of horseshit, Matt.
To do worse than Josh Richard. Back in the days when six was eight track, relax and jump to it like Duran Duran. Black is what we still get a tan. Over to your girl, hey, what's your number? You and your crew must be dumb and dumber. Timberland, understand. Kicking the fly beats on my fly band.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming at you live here on a Monday night from inside the PTB Man Cave. We are trekking our way through season 3 of the PTB podcast, and of course I do need to bring in my PIC, my partner in crime, the one and only, Scott Criscola. Scott, how you doing?
Good evening, JR. How you doing on this Monday night? Swimmingly, weather's nice. Actually, we're starting a little hint of spring here in the Northeast. Pretty good. Hoops weather's coming for you, my friend.
Yeah, wait, next week.
So I need to find a softball team. I'm a gypsy this summer. I need to find a team to play on. A free agent. Maybe the Yankees need me. God knows they need me. Look, they're looking for everybody else. So they need another pitcher on their staff. I'm available.
Well, you Welcome do fit the age profile. So.
Exactly. See, I'm using it to my advantage. I'll work for $3 million a year and incentives. Welcome, PTB Nation, to episode 205 of the Place to Be podcast. Before we start, I need to ask this question. I've been thinking about it all day, JR. I've been a little nervous. I need to ask you this, and please be honest with me. You're not an Aces and Eights, are you?
We have a signed hockey puck from star New Jersey Devils winger Adam Henrique.
I was about to join Aces and Eights that night.
I may or may not have 6 minutes worth of audio.
You're going to bore people with my... For those that don't know, that was from Saturday night. JR and his lovely wife, daughter, and mother-in-law came to the Nutmeg State for Dr. G's and my fine charity St. Patrick's Day dinner for our fine Knights of Columbus Council. And that was me pimping raffle prizes. So you probably hear a myriad of that throughout the evening. But I'm saying that because I was monitoring Lords of Pain. I didn't buy it. I was trying to find a free streaming site to watch Lockdown last night, but I couldn't find one without having to go through some weird secondary window, and I feel like downloading extra shit and something bad happening. So I was checking it out on Lords of Pain. And for those that don't know, who didn't watch Lockdown last night, we have a new TNA heavyweight champion, and that is Bully Ray. And yes, he is the head of Aces and Eights, which I think everybody seemed to have probably figured out for about the last 9 months, probably even before I started watching. So yeah, apparently he worked Brooke over, he worked Hogan over, and all this other jazz. So 3D is back together, and now they're all nomads. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's good that he's back as a heel. I think that's a good place for them to be. I just some of the stuff was just hokey the way they got there. But if the end result is him as the main heel and the world champion, I think he deserves both of those things. Hopefully, it doesn't lead to a match with Hogan. But
oh God, I hope not either. Well, that's the whole thing. A lot of people were saying. We'll see because, you know, this Thursday night's the big live impact from Chicago. So the whole thing they're saying is, all right, well, you beat the hell out of him a month ago. Would you fake beat him up 2 months ago?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was and even on the pay-per-view itself, he was fighting aces and eights. So those are the minor quibbles. You know, and the storyline's been taking forever to get here, and yeah, it's hard, you know, look past all the stuff Bubba and D-Von have been through over the last couple of years in TNA feuding and everything. But it's wrestling. That part you can overlook. And like I said, I think they're better off with him as a heel and being world champion than him being Hogan's lackey son-in-law. So this is probably the way to go for now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, they probably, well, I don't want this to come off like an endorsement of Brooke as being anything good, but I'm thinking maybe she should have turned with him.
You mean kind of go along with the whole kind of reproduce Triple H and Stephanie, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically redoing it anyway.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, who knows? She may have. I don't know. She barely gets off as a babyface. I don't know if I could stomach her as a heel.
No, yeah. I don't think she'd be any good in the role. But
I mean, then again, Stephanie's promos were pretty awful in the beginning, and then she kind of settled in. So I don't know. Maybe Brooke has a future. Who knows? Anyway, that was the only title I think that changed hands last night. Velvet Sky kept the Knockouts title. Kenny King kept the, I don't know, did the team, nope, but Rude and Aries kept the tag. I think every other belt stayed.
Yeah, I think you're
except,
right.
Except the world
big
title.
Upset, though, was Wes Briscoe defeated Kurt Angle with a little
assistance. Yes, he did. And that's good. And I had a feeling Wes Briscoe was going to win because Kurt's that kind of guy to put him over. And I'm glad Team TNA won, Sting and James Storm and all those guys. So at least with Bully Ray as a heel, some of the good, better baby faces. And Bobby Roode did re-sign, so he is sticking around. That's good. He's one of the few legit homegrown TNA guys I like.
Yeah, he might as well stay there at this point.
He'll get buried.
And he's young enough anyway. I think he is. I know. I should probably check before I say that. But I'm pretty sure he's young enough where, you know, he could jump eventually. He doesn't need to go now. Right. Let me see how old he is.
So, anyway, I don't want to talk about TNA all night. But
yeah, he's, well, actually, he's 35.
That's not that bad.
No, yeah, he could do another year or so.
He
there
could do another yeah.
Come in for his final years.
Yeah, so.
Anyway, all right.
Anyway, I'll go through the whole thing. I just wanted to just briefly mention that lockdown was last night. The next pay-per-view, yep. JR, you mentioned to me briefly over the weekend, Slammiversary, guess what? June 2nd, day after my birthday. So, something to think about. And it's in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were discussing what the building would be. I guess it's
going to be TD Garden. I can't imagine they'd run the Aganis. I'm not sure how big that is, but I don't think it's... And to go from the Alamo Dome to a college campus for a pay-per-view doesn't really make sense, especially when you're only doing, you know, 4 a year or whatever it is. So,
well, I mean, I wonder if I hope WWE doesn't break their balls. Just let them have the pay-per-view. It gives a crap.
Again,
a
arena holds 7,200.
Oh, that's not enough. That's not enough. No, do it at the Garden. Even if you paper it, you could still probably get, you know, 11 or 12.
Yeah, well, Garden holds 20 grand. So,
yeah, if they can get like between 9 and 12, that's fine for them. Paid. So, but we're working on a little something for that. We'll talk about that as the weeks progress. Anyway, all right.
Let's talk about like zero segue room. When I try and like pause or edit anything, it's impossible. I have to literally cut your word in half because this is one breath right to the next.
Well, I'm doing this is the podcast version of what Impact is watching. It's Jesus. Like, all right, and Kenny King wins the TNA X Division title, and he stands up. All right, let's go backstage now to hear AJ Styles.
All right, take a breath for a second. I was going to plug your shit, too. You can read more TNA, more Impact, and the fallout from this pay-per-view, and Scott's tremendous Impact review will be posted over the weekend. You can read his raw thoughts on the Bigelow34.proboards.com message board, as well as WrestlingRambles.com. Scott's new home is the Raw recapper.
Yeah, and this past week, JR, a lot of... A lot of responses from last week's Raw. The Wrestling Rambles page got I had about a 15 or 16 comment thread going from my site, so or from that review. So, and tonight, right after we're done with this, I'll dive into tonight's Raw, and it'll be up this evening. So, but yeah, I do Main Event, which irked me last week. Mm-hmm. Impact was.
I think you've cursed Main Event. It has not been the same since you took over the
Rams. Yeah, I agree. I'm really annoyed. I'm really upset. I don't know what I did wrong.
It was like awesome until you got involved.
I know, and now like and now things. Like the worst guys are jobbing, and well, I don't know, whatever, and now you know, Impact's not bad, and SmackDown, you know, there's never a great SmackDown, but there's never a terrible SmackDown. So, okay, what is tonight's show about, JR? Let us know.
Well, this is a very special episode because this is the second piece of Mr. Mike Rude's prize. He won the Jay Womet DVD contest. He was on with us last week to review Royal Rumble 1999. And he also chose a topic for us to discuss, and we decided to choose tonight to do that, and that is the return, Scott, Scott James Criscolo.
James. James.
Jonathan.
Joseph.
Oh.
But that's my TNA name, Scott James.
Jesus.
Jesus. What is it?
The return. The return, Scott Criscolo, of Listomania.
What? That's true, Vince. It certainly is. Vince would have loved my workout tonight. Oof. Hanging and banging.
I hope you wear the tight black tank top and black jeans.
Yes, I worked out in black jeans. I only work out in black. And I told my regular trainer, take a night. Take the night off because Shane's working with me tonight.
Oh, jeez.
So, anyway. All right. Anyway,
so the return of Listomania, where Scott and I will be ranking the greatest wrestling managers of all time.
Yes. So I'm excited about
this.
It
should be fun. So what we did, Scott, we set our own little criteria. We decided to just do no valets. So this may lead to a little controversy. We racked our brains. We cut the point off around the pay-per-view era. We went back a few years from WWF's pay-per-view era. We're going to kick it off with 1983.
Yep.
So we figured the Starrcade era on is where we have our cut point. So there's a lot of guys on here that either are missing or maybe lower because we're factoring the body of work from 83 on. So
yeah, so pretty much the two, we'll just say it now, the two most glaring omissions. Might as well just get out of the way now.
Yeah.
There will be no Arnie Skoland, and there will be no Grand Wizard.
Right.
Because they were obviously their salad years were obviously in the mid to late 70s. So.
Will you stop?
I apologize, Gorilla. I think one of them managed you, most likely. I think Grand Wizard did when he was a heel.
No Red Bastion.
Red Bastion.
But yeah, there are a couple that are aren't here, or they may come up lower. As we're moving along, you may question why they're so low. But again, that's because this is from 83 on. We did not factor in other promotions outside of the major U.S. one. So it's pretty much just all, WWF, WCW, ECW, and as well as the territory. So World Class factors in, Stampede, AWA. Yeah, so that stuff definitely factors into the rankings. Mainly just the major American promotions from 83 on are factored in here. There are a few that we're probably missing from, like, Ring of Honor this decade. Like, I kind of just realized we don't have Prince Nana on there and little ones like that. A couple from TNA are on here, but you'll see as we move. So we came up with 34 managers.
Yep.
So we're going to rank the top 34. Like I said, no valets, so no Miss Elizabeth. There is a couple women on here that we consider to be more managers than valets. No Francine was one we had a debate about. And, you know, a couple others like that. So it's mainly just you had to be considered a manager more than just a, valet.
Yeah, you had to be able to cut promos for your guys, and most valets didn't. Some did, but most didn't.
You had to be positioned as a manager, someone who managed, and that wasn't just accompanying the wrestler to the ring.
Yeah. Another one that I remember we debated, I remember talking to our good friend Chad Campbell about Soup. Let me just double check, make sure she's not on here. I don't believe she is. No, one that's not on here is Baby Doll.
Yeah. But well, she was definitely always positioned more as a valet.
She was a valet.
She was
never
in a position of power. Yeah.
No, exactly. So, all right. So, JR and I, this is another new thing we're going to do. This is the first Listomania. I believe this is the first Listomania.
No, we did it for, I don't know if it counts, but Survivor Series, we did just one list. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So
Mania and SummerSlam were the other way around.
Yeah. So, we from this point forward, obviously, starting with Survivor Series, one list because it just gets – you and I agree in like 85% of the time.
Yeah, and it just got to be way too confusing trying to keep track of where we were. So, what we did was we each submitted a list, and we had a third-party verifier, the aforementioned Chad Campbell, review it and determine, how it would flesh out. Then Scott and I took the ones that were tied, and we debated and bartered back and forth. There was a couple of deals we had to strike to get our rankings the way we wanted them.
Yes.
And we came up with this list of 34, and we'll ask you again at the end of the show, but you should provide your list on the Bigelow 34 Pro Boards message board. I'll set up a thread, and you can post your top manager's list.
Yes. And it was almost like, DiBiase and Slick?
Yes.
You're trading Rumble
hands in the back room. So we are not going to provide biographical information. If you want that, you can go to Wikipedia or Graham's page or anything else. We're just going to talk about our memories of these managers, what their careers meant to us, our memories of them, and, the job we thought they did in the promotions they were in.
Yeah. Okay. So there's 34 total. JR and I will alternate. And let us begin. All right. At the bottom of the list, and this one is strictly because he was just absolutely hilarious TV fodder for a very brief window. At number 34 is the great Chavo Classic, who, of course, managed throughout most of 2004 on SmackDown. Managed, obviously, his son, Chavo. And he was involved in the whole feud with Rey and for the Cruiserweight title. And then, of course, there was the silly thing with Jacqueline and all that kind of stuff. But Chavo Classic was one of those guys who just... It was nice, at least in that mid-2000s, where you can actually have a legit manager, an old, like, grizzled guy.
Good. I figure you need some good background music for this one.
There you go. I'm doing the little circle in air, the air circle. Here we go. Yeah. No, Chavo Classic was an awesome manager, strictly because he just was funny. He did a lot of, you know, funny skits, and he really kind of... He was one of the highlights of what was actually a kind of a blah 2004 on SmackDown.
Especially the summer when he was mainly on. He came in January with the whole, you know, Chavo-Eddie feud, and he kind of made it like he was going to be a peacemaker, and then he ended up joining Chavo Jr., his son, and managed him from there until, I think it was the fall, right? Or late summer when he got in that fight in the Cauliflower Alley Club, whatever that happened, and he ended up shit-canning him because of it, but...
Yeah,
at that point, he actually won the Cruiserweight title. Don't forget, he had the feud with Jacqueline, I believe, and all that stuff. So, I really dug him in this role. He was always funny, like you said. He'd walk down and do the weird pointing in a circle and pointing at Chavo Jr. And this is a good dirtbag dad heel. Dirtbag.
What you're gonna say? Never mind.
That's definitely not what I was saying. I was definitely saying dirtbag. Dirtbag heel. That was out there just doing what he could to help his son win matches and would do whatever it took. And just slimy, fit right in with the Guerrero stereotype, for better or worse, within the WWE. And it's one of my guilty pleasures of 04.
Absolutely. And the fact that he won a title was pretty funny. So you didn't see that often. Even in the Federation years, you didn't see that too often. So there you go. Number 34, the bottom of our list, is Chavo Classic.
Number 33, checking in here, the one and only Mr. Yoga himself, Diamond Dallas Page. And, of course, this counts as time in the AWA and early on in WCW is with the Diamond Stud, the Diamond Dolls, with Vinny Vegas.
Vinny Vegas. And, AWA, managed Bad Company.
Yeah, and that's where he got his start in AWA. Of course, he was friends with Eric Bischoff, and he brought him over to WCW. And he did a, fine job. Nothing outstanding, but it definitely got him on the map. Mm-hmm. I liked all the swag. He was someone that really brought a character as a manager. He wasn't just a guy out there being a manager, basically. He had this whole gimmick portrayed where he was this, flamboyant, over-the-top club owner, and he had the dolls with him and really just carried that swag over to his wrestlers, the Diamond Exchange.
Yep, and... I liked him early on in his AWA run because, God forbid, there was any kind of effervescence in AWA. Everything was pretty bland and dull. There were a couple of the managers. We'll talk about them a little further up the list in AWA. But DDP, particularly in that last stretch, he was mostly manager. If I can remember, I think he started
He started in 88.
88. I was about to say, I was thinking a little early, maybe later, 86, early 87.
He started in 88 with Bad Company. And then he also managed Colonel DeBeers, was a big one. Kurt Hennig and Medusa Miceli were in the Diamond Exchange.
Yep.
He did 12 dates over 9 months, worked as a color commentator in FCW as well, and then he had his tryout with 3WF. That's where they had the pink Cadillac. Didn't really go anywhere, and then signed on in WCW in 1991. So that's where he got his start. And, one of the true success stories, a guy that worked his way up from the bottom at an older age, as a manager, became a star wrestler, world champion.
Yeah, and...
Scotty Flamingo was also part of his group in WCW.
Oh, Scotty Flamingo. The name you'll remember a little bit further down the line. But for me, it was all about his run there early on in AWA, because he really added a lot of, particularly by 88 when the company was, treading an ocean load of water. Mm-hmm. He actually added a lot of... I love using this word because it really fits him, effervescence to a very kind of stale, bland, dull promotion. I know, and Mick Foley has said it in a couple of his DVDs, the actual wrestling in AWA was not terrible. Vern still was good at putting together good, solid matches. The problem is there was nothing around them. It was like watching Olympic wrestling. That's what he wanted you to do. the wrestling. And that's fine. But the problem was, you know, you can have a little sizzle to go with the steak. And DDP brought that. And I applaud him for that. So, yeah, he was one of my favorites early on in my wrestling watching was DDP in AWA because he brought a lot of excitement to an otherwise dull promotion. So there we go. Number 33 on our list.
Interesting. No, he was actually fired in 92, late 92, because he tore his rotator cuff, and Kevin Nash, who's the Diamond Stud, left for WWF in 93.
Nope.
I'm sorry, it was Vinny Vegas, Diamond Stud of Scott Hall. Yep.
Yeah.
So Nash left in 92, late 92, early 93. Page was fired. He came back after seeking the help of Jake Roberts to help him on the psychological aspects of the business. And, of course, that mitzvah given by Jake Roberts to DDP has been repaid now with the yoga stuff and him helping Jake get into shape and helping turn his life around. DDP said he felt he owed it to him to do this. And, of course, that started way back in 92, 93 when he helped him kind of figure out that aspect of wrestling. Came back in 94 in the ring as a competitor, no longer as a manager.
Yep. So, and, of course, as JR mentioned, career speaks for itself in WCW. He would eventually become world champion. So there we go. Number 33 on the list. Diamond Dallas Page. At number 32 is a guy who became kind of a later era manager and a damn good one.
Yeah, an era that you don't really, it wasn't known for managers.
Right, and number 32 is Armando Alejandro Estrada in the Matt Rotella way. Rada.
Oh my God.
The Samoan Bulldozer. Yes, of course. Armando Estrada.
You get down to the ring to face off with my Umaga. Ha
ha. I loved it. He was awesome.
He was great,
loved,
wasn't
Estrada.
He?
And we needed more guys. His only problem was he needed more guys.
Yeah, more guys in a longer run. He definitely would be up higher on this list. The only reason he's this low is he has such a short run. And don't forget, they transitioned him out of being a manager over to the ECW GM pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And then he was let go. He started to wrestle a little bit towards the end of that stint. And he's a guy that I thought had more of a future. I'm not sure what happened with him, why they had to let him go. But I feel like he didn't really maximize his potential. And it was great that they really dedicated to a manager at a time where they just weren't used anymore. And they really let him act in that role. It wasn't just like a one-month thing. You know, they portrayed him as a great manager.
Right. No, they did. And Umaga was a machine when he started with Estrada. And I'm trying to remember, did he last all the way to – did he come out with Umaga at 23?
Yes, because this says he it looks like he was still around even into May in what turned out to be Estrada's last appearance for months. He was written off TV because creative team decided there were too many people at ringside at WrestleMania 23 for the Umaga-Lashley match. And I guess, you know, don't forget Umaga kind of became a tool of Vince and Shane – and that whole stuff going on with Bobby Lashley.
With Lashley,
so
right.
I think they just thought Estrada was redundant, and then Umaga ended up kind of turning face anyway. So he returned as the GM of ECW in 07, August 14th, 07. He was released on November 18th, 2008, after some inactivity. He had been wrestling and then had his last match on August 5th. So.
Okay. Yeah, but what cracked me up is instead of him like hooking up with somebody else or bringing up another young guy, they just kind of transitioned him and he became that was the problem, I think. Not to start on a totally other topic, but that was the problem I think a lot of people had with the new ECW. It was, all right, this guy's not doing anything. Throw him over there. We got room for him there. And that's what happened with everybody. And instead of giving Estrada some guys to manage,
right?
Stick him in ECW. That's
and even ECW, he was okay. He just was being wasted in his potential. But he was a good talker, so I thought he was fine even as GM. So a few fun facts on him, actually. The last match he won, he defeated Tommy Dreamer to win his contract to make, because remember he kept fighting for a contract. That was the whole thing. To he got fired as GM and he wanted to be a wrestler and he kept losing matches. He finally beat Tommy with the assist of a heel turn for Colin Delaney. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
And so then that was his last appearance, the match he won his contract. He hit the indie circuit, teamed with Elijah Burke, but they lost to Thunder and Lightning for the World Tag Team titles at the WWC.
Wow. And you know what the last thing they told Estrada before he walked out the door? You get out of here, you sore loser!
Yes, the former. The former.
Former.
WCF Tag Team Champions.
That's right.
And one other fun fact, which I had completely blanked on, he actually re-signed with WWE in 2010, December, was used on the May 26, 2011 episode of Superstars when he was a one-night manager for Tyson Kidd. don't know if you remember that. The kid was trying to find different manager every week.
Yeah.
And he actually had shed the whole entire image and the character and the accent and everything else. He was like just a businessman. And then that was the only time he was on TV. He was released again last July. So.
Okay. So there we go.
And he owns a restaurant, Baby's Steak and Lemonade, in Glendale, Arizona, but it closed.
Bummer. You say it as if, oh, let's go to... oh, never
mind. And he appeared in a Cypress Hill video.
Oh, really? Interesting. All right. So there we go. Number 32 on our list of the place to be Listomania greatest managers of all time, Armando Estrada. Who's next, JR?
Number 31. Mm-hmm. One of my personal favorites growing up, former wrestler, job duty, turned manager. The Genius.
What?
Of course, he turned into a manager. He turned into the character in 88 and then began managing Mr. Perfect. First, he was kind of associated with him and then started managing him straight up. Late 89 into 90. Of course, would also be associated with the great Beverly Brothers before departing in 93. So
that was a great word, by the way. You just brought up a great word.
Beverly Brothers?
For guys. Well, that's always a great word. No, the word associate. That was a great terminology in the late, mid-late 80s in the Federation years. Everybody was that's what Flair used to call everybody. Everybody was an associate. I'm an associate of the champion. That was one of those awesome, like, terminologies back then. But, yes, he was an associate of Mr. Perfect.
Yeah, so he was only with Perfect till WrestleMania 6. When Perfect won the IC title in that tournament and he hooked up with Bobby Heenan, Genius went back to just being kind of a part-time wrestler. And then would become a manager again in the fall of 91 with the Beverly Brothers. So about a year and a half almost, he was active back in the ring and then managed the Beverly till he left at the end of 92.
Yeah.
I always like the Genius. Of course, he's remembered for other not as memorable feuds. Of course, his issues with Jameson that dominated most of 92 with the Bushwhackers and everything else.
God.
But I always liked him as a character. I liked the poetry. I thought it was good, easy heel heat. He was a guy that could back it up because he was smart, and also a guy that could back it up in the ring when he had to, because he could, he could really go. And we saw that in a lot of those house shows. If you watch that stuff from the 80s, mid-80s, when he was still just Lanny Poffo, he had some great matches. But I thought he was a good, smarmy heel manager at a time where heel managers were in vogue, and he was a guy that maybe wasn't always heavily focused on. He was considered probably more lower mid-card once he got away from Perfect. But that run of Perfect was pretty big. I mean, don't forget, he had matches with Hulk Hogan on Saturday's main event and everything else, the tag matches. And he had the pay-per-view match of Beefcake. So he had a very good stretch there from late 89 to early 90.
Yeah. And he actually won that match.
Yeah. Who? Which one? The Hogan one, not the Beefcake.
The Hogan one. No, yeah, the Hogan one. Oh, the Beefcake one was just it was one of the worst matches ever, unfortunately. That was a lot of that was poor booking shenanigans with the referee that got knocked out, and then he calls a DQ when he's unconscious. And,
yeah.
The match is a mess, but he did beat Hogan on Saturday's main event, though.
And then they had the big payoff at WrestleMania when Beefcake cut his hair.
Yes. Yep. So there we go. Number 31 on our list. He went from tossing frisbees to managing the Beverly Brothers. We love the Genius. And he is the roadblock for why his brother is not in the WWE Hall of Fame. it is. In any event, but we like him anyway. All right, number 30 on our list. Kind of a wild card here, JR. Guy you don't totally think of. Again, a guy who's been around the block many times. Very close friend of Eric Bischoff. Him and Bischoff have been friends for a long time. And he was one of the premier managers in WCW. And that is the one, the only, Sonny Ono.
Yes, and Sonny Ono. When he debuted as a part of a major storyline in late 95, mm-hmm. He came on and he wanted to buy a portion of WCW, where he would actually buy TV time on the weekend syndicates to showcase his Japanese stable, his Japanese representatives. And that actually led to a New Japan versus WCW Best of Seven series at Starrcade that year.
Yes.
Brought in Jushin Liger, Koji Kanemoto, Masahiro Chono, Masa Saito, Shinjiro Otani, mm-hmm. Hiroshi Tenzan, and Kensuke Sasaki.
One of the best matches on that show. I think it's Otani, I think, fought Eddie, right? I don't know if you have the card in front of you. I think it was Eddie and Otani. I think it's on the Best of Starrcade DVD. But from fantastic match. It's not much I remember really from that Starrcade, but I do remember that match. I think it's Otani.
That might be one of our – maybe it'll be in the next Pick Your Big One poll. We'll throw that one in, because that's definitely one I could – I remember watching it quite a few times at – you know, in the mid-90s when I had it on tape, but I haven't watched it in a long time since.
I think it's on our...
Yeah, Otani defeated Eddie Guerrero at 13:43.
Yeah, that's an awesome match. I'm pretty sure it's on the that Ultimate Collection that came out a few years ago, the Starrcade set. And I think the show is on... I think it's on one of our tapes.
I'm sure it is. So, Ono, after that, of course, he stuck around, managed various guys. One was Masachono whenever he would pop in. In 96, he actually turned on Ono and became the first international member of the NWO.
Yes.
Oh, so Ono, of course, I think the man I most associate with him in WCW is Ultimo Dragon. He was with him for a while, and then he actually ended up turning on Dragon and feuding with him. He managed Bull Nakano briefly in WCW. So a lot of Bull Nakano against Ikara Hukuto.
The second one sounded like a dish. I'd like some of the Ikara Hukuto, please.
Ikara Hukuto. So he, after he turned on Ultimo Dragon, he took Psychosis and the Parka under his wing, and they had a big feud, and Psychosis and Dragon had a respect match at the Bash. So a lot of cool stuff with Ono. He stuck around. Then he became the manager, of course, of Ernest Miller when he turned heel. Yep. Stuck around until 99. He was released, and he was one of the men that filed that racial discrimination lawsuit in 2000. And once Bischoff was fired, he claimed that they were all dumped, given disrespectful gimmicks, and his final salary was pretty crap, and he said they were being held back because of their race. But for a time there in the mid-90s, he was definitely one of the premier, like you said, one of the premier managers in WCW.
Yeah, I know you think of Ultimo Dragon. I actually think of Chono in the beginning there with when he came out with the big long leather jacket and like those weird kind of slap together NWO shirts where they really started to kind of hone what the logo was. And
of course, me, Gino is yelling at him, "Speak English, damn it!"
Yeah, and you're telling me, "Oh, I wonder why he filed the lawsuit."
Yeah, I know.
which is weird because, like I said, this was in Bischoff's book. I don't know if you Controversy Creates Cash. I don't know if you read it, JR.
A while ago.
Yeah. That whole – when he talks about it, I don't remember what DVD it was. It might have been on the – I think it's on the AWA DVD. When Bischoff talks about that whole Star Wars – Ninja Star Wars game that he was trying to pimp with AWA, that was Sonny Ono.
Okay.
That was him and Sonny Ono. They were business partners. So he's known Sonny Ono since like the mid-80s.
Yep, and of course he's a big martial arts and kickboxing guy. And that's where they met in the 70s as a martial artist. He was touring. And they played that up when he was a manager, too. He'd do a lot of that stuff at ringside on his guy's opponents. He also managed, I don't want to forget, Yuji Nagata. That was a big one, too. He feuded with the Dragon before he went to Ernest Miller. Yep. Ono. So there you go. Sonny Ono checking in at number 30.
All right. There you go, JR. We got a little twofer coming up. The next two, right up your alley.
Two
number
of my
29.
Boys? Well, I think this is...
Boy. Yeah, well, not exactly, but although now you may not know what you. Anyway, go to 29, then we'll make fun of 28. Go ahead.
Okay.
Next up,
this is one of my main boys.
Yes.
The great Johnny Polo, a run that was way too short, deserved a lot better than he would receive. He, of course, debuted in 93 as a manager of Atom Bomb. Then he hooked up with the Quebecers, became tag team and manager greatness.
What was it about him you loved?
I don't know. He just had a great look. He was like Jim Cornette light, really. He had the rich baby gimmick, and he was just really funny dude. And him and the Quebecers were hilarious. They'd cut these promos on the syndicated shows that were just great. Doing the fake rap against Men on a Mission, leading into WrestleMania 10. He's just a funny guy. He's just really. I loved how they were always upbeat and happy, him and the Quebecers, and always nothing ever seemed to bother them. They're always just making fun of people and being goofballs. Mm. I really dug that. And, of course, he led the Quebecers to the tag titles, defeat the Steiner brothers on Raw, and they held them all the way till May the next year when they lost to the Headshrinkers. After that, Polo was phased out, kind of just did Coliseum video work, did All-American Wrestling alongside Gorilla Monsoon until August when he left. Did a lot of booking, too, during that time. If you listen to any shoot interviews with him, of course, he'd become Raven eventually. But the Johnny Polo gimmick, I thought, was just really well done. I thought it fit him, and it was just a funny guy. I mean, we always talk about some of the commentary he did on those Coliseum tapes, and him and Gorilla would just have these inane conversations that were just fantastic and so funny.
While they were talking about these matches.
Yes. So.
Yes. I'm trying to remember when did we catch that line? I believe it was, the second. Maybe it wasn't the second. Maybe they only had one. It was a Sean Marty match, in the cage. Might have been the cage DVD. The original one, that first one that came out like in 2004.
Yep.
I think that's where, because it was on one of those. Those mixtapes, those Coliseum video exclusives from like the early 90s. And I think it was Gorilla and Polo. And I like talking about these matches.
Yeah, that was a good one. And he was very, very smart guy. So it corresponded well. And it was just a good mix, him and the Quebecers. I thought they just worked well together. They had instant chemistry, and they were just fun to watch. I think that's what made them so great, just fun to watch.
Yeah, no, they absolutely
It's hard not to smile watching anything to do with the Quebecers and Johnny Polo.
You know, it's funny. When we were doing the Royal Rumble 94 review, they seemed so big time. Like, when they, you know, obviously their match, they took on Owen and Brett, and we all know what happened from that. But, like, when Owen and Brett were getting ready, like, they made the Quebecers out to be real, you know, big. I mean, yeah, they were the tag team champions, but, you know, as you said, they were more like a comedy act. But they seemed very big time at that show. You know, here are the world tag team champions, the Quebecers with Johnny Polo. They weren't just a, I don't know, they just felt special at that show, that they weren't just a couple of humps, you know. It was different at WrestleMania
10. Yeah, definitely. 10, but, and this was a team, too, that had defeated the Steiners. I mean, I know they did it kind of nefariously, but that was kind of what put them over, was their intelligence, that they outsmarted the stupid Steiners. And week after week, they kept outsmarting them. And they had, of course, one little hiccup with the kid and Holly. But overall, they were pretty dominant during that stretch.
Yes. Yeah. So there you go. At number 29, the iconic.
Hey, I may have a winner.
No, he wasn't a manager. He'd be a good one, though. Probably would have fallen over or something, but at number 29, the iconic Johnny Polo. All right, we were cracking jokes about this a moment ago. At number 28 on our list is our first woman, and no, it's not woman, although that's one we there was another one that we kind of were back and forth on. Was she a valet? Was she a manager? I think it all depended on the role in the company with her, so that was a tough one to kind of gauge. But this one,
yeah, she was as close to borderline as it gets. I mean, you probably could make an argument that she could have been on here, but, yeah, but again, most of her late run was as a valet.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, it was tough to.
How many? Oh, two grandstand seats at Fenway Pack.
Forgot who won those.
Who cares?
I almost didn't want to do that, but I don't want to piss off the few Red Sox fans that spent a lot of raffle tickets. All right, at number 28.
I'm gonna write that right across the bottom of the Mets silent auction page.
What? Who cares? At number 28 on our list, she's easily the last great, in my opinion, last great female manager.
Easily being the key word.
Easily, yeah. Even though we have some women higher on the list, for my personal opinion, I think she's the last really great one. And that is, even though right now she probably wouldn't remember any of them, and she's the first true WWE diva. And that is, of course, Cloudy.
Yes.
Yeah, right. No. Of course, I'm talking about Miss Sitch herself, the great Sunny. And Sunny was a manager. She was not a valet by any stretch of the imagination. She was definitely a manager.
Oh, yeah. She was always presented as a manager. And a smart one at that, and a competent and successful one. She kind of followed in Lou Albano's big, fat, sloppy shoes as being the like kind of tag team gold digger. She started, of course, with Skip. Well, actually, you could even count her, you know, pretty successful Smoky Mountain run with, as Chris, you know, Tammy Sitch with Chris Candido was portrayed well there. Came over as Skip and Sonny in 95, managed the Body Donnas to tag gold. They left the loss to the Godwins. She jumped ship to them for 2 weeks, and then she turned on them and helped the Guns win. And that was where she was probably best known as, was that whole summer of 96 with the Guns. You know, was briefly aligned with Farouk in late 96, and then kind of took a hiatus from managing until she came back with LOD in 98, but that, you know, just done by that point.
Yeah,
but she was, you know, the apple of many teenage eyes, I believe, mine included, in 1996.
She, I will say this, though, JR, the only reason the difference is with Sonny, the gold digging was part of the storyline. For Captain Lou, it was real life.
Yeah,
he was just
right.
Climbing on in real life. There's a difference. Sonny knew how to successfully use her feminine wiles to win championships. And again, she with her, you know, boyfriend, fiance, on and off, husband, maybe whatever, Chris Candido. And again, it goes back to what, 93, 94 in Smoky Mountain. Her problem ultimately was her own demons. By late 97, she was, you know.
Yeah, I think it was even before that where she kind of went off the rails. But
yeah.
I mean, through 96, she was, even in 97, 98, she was still the it girl. But 96 was really where she took off. And I mean, she was so popular at that point, just dominating the AOL site. They had just galleries of her pictures. I had every Raw magazine poster known to man that had Sonny on it was hanging on my wall. And, you know, I was very, very proud to say we shared the same birthday at the time. I felt somehow that united us. But
I like the way you said at the time. Like right now, she probably can't remember her birthday. So
it's, you know, it is sad what's happened to her. But I mean, in '96, she was definitely the, like you said, predominant, the first official diva. Yeah. At a time where managers or females weren't really, you know, you had Miss Elizabeth, who was beautiful, but you didn't really have any sexy divas until this point, sexy females, right. Unless, you know, Alundra right. Blaze is your deal, but most people weren't, I don't think, that into Alundra. But by 96, Sunny was really, holy shit, you know, this is amazing.
Yeah, and sadly, she could have had a much better career by 98. Obviously, other, you know, other girls like Terry and Sable were starting to, you know, take a piece of her spotlight, but she was a mess by then anyway. And she would continue on. She'd go to ECW, bounce around. And you could just tell that she was just not looking good anymore. She was getting a little chunky.
Yeah, as one of those people that is going out and just going through the motions those last couple of years in ECW and WCW, just trying to get by. It was kind of sad. You see her come into WCW and they're, you know, presenting her as this hot sex pot still. And she, you know, was clearly not in the shape she used to be in. At that point, and you know, up and down over the last decade or so, especially since the passing of Candido. But on this list, she ranks here just because of the success she had in '96 and what she did to revolutionize the return of the sexy, you know, woman in wrestling.
Yes. So number 28 on our list of mania for the greatest managers of all time, the always gorgeous, never forgotten Sunny. One of my favorites up next, JR.
Number 27.
Yes.
A man who made an unexpected return to wrestling this year.
Yes.
The one and only Dirty Dutch Mantel, a.k.a.
Yeah.
Zeb Coulter.
Yep.
Of course, Dutch, big time manager all around the world. Mm-hmm. Known in the WWF as being Uncle Zebekiah with the Blue Brothers and Justin Hawk Bradshaw. And then has returned now, of course, with Mr. Jack Thwaga. But tell us a little bit about the early days of Zeb.
That's a Dirty Dutch kind of bounced around. He managed a lot in Mid-South, obviously in Mid-Atlantic. Unfortunately, his claim
to fame.
A lot
in Puerto Rico, too.
Yeah, his claim to fame, unfortunately, was that pretty bad commentating of that horrendous pay-per-view in 1999.
Oh, the Heroes of Wrestling? I forgot he did that.
Yeah. He was, it started in the 70s. He was Wayne Mason Dixon. And
name.
I know. But his real name is Wayne Maurice Keown. Keown.
That's right, revealed on the stupid YouTube videos a few weeks ago.
Yes. He later became Dutch Mantel. But here's a little trivia, JR. Did not add Dirty until 1980.
Okay.
A lot of Southern promotions. Think of some guys. He actually
the shooter of the baller, yeah.
Yep, and he managed the Blade Runners.
Mm-hmm.
Managed Sting and the Ultimate Warrior. He were, you know, two guys who actually helped train, or that Dutch helped train, were Undertaker and Kane, Brothers of Destruction. He's also credited with giving Steve Austin his name Austin, and that's known in the that's on the Stone Cold DVD. He came up with the name Austin because Steve couldn't be Steve Williams because obviously people would be confused with Dr. Death.
Mm-hmm.
He would go to, he would kind of, again, bounce around. He had a lot of big, feuds in Memphis, as JR mentioned, with Lawler. He'd go to WCW in the early 90s. He would be a commentator with Tony worldwide.
Yeah, they did the, your definition there could be terrible or awesome, the Desperados with Black Bart and Deadeye Dick. And they kept looking for Stan Hansen, who had already left. So it was kind of stupid. Yes. Went to Smoky Mountain for a little bit, and yeah, just a guy that's been all around, but everyone knows. You know, you don't hear too many bad things about him at all. Of course, had the tragedy last year. Remember, we talked about it with Downtown Bruno when he was on, of course, was that his granddaughter was killed in a car crash by a drunk driver who had been running from the police.
Yep.
Both passed away, 16-year-old granddaughter, in August of 2012. Since then, he's returned, like we said, under the name Zeb Coulter, managing Jack Swagger. What do you think of his new run? Hold up to his old stuff so far?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. He has not flubbed, really not flubbed one promo since he's been here. He is dead on. And Swagger needs to be thanking him and giving him a piece of his check. Well, I'm sure Zeb's getting paid. But my point is he's I don't want to say he's saving the storyline because I think Del Rio's been awesome, but definitely an added bonus. And I think the storyline – I think people of the two title matches at Mania, I think people are going to enjoy the build for this one almost as much as the build for Rock Cena, because I think you're going to see a lot more, obviously, out of this feud.
I think you've been optimistic. I mean, I haven't seen too many people excited for it at all. I think it's just that title, honestly, Scott. I think it's hard to get too into a match for that title.
Probably.
Maybe since Triple H Batista. Other than that.
Well, Taker Batista at 23. Edge. Edge is probably the last one that really made it great.
I mean, those are great matches. I'm saying to feel like it's, wow, this is a world title feud, yeah. You know?
Well, that's because...
I mean, there's a good chance that match may open the fucking show, so it's hard.
It did. It almost, yeah.
It
well,
did, yeah, it did with Del Rio and Edge a couple years ago.
Yeah, and, the problem is the higher main eventers, you know, the real, real main eventer guys in the company are feuding with the other belt. And they've been doing that for the last, you know, the belts haven't switched.
Yeah.
Probably the last time that belt, whatever belt is, look, whatever belt is on SmackDown is going to suffer. We all know that. So the stretch when, you know, Triple H and Batista and those guys in 03, 04, 05, you know, Benoit and Shawn, when the belt was on that show, that belt was bigger. And the WWE belt with Cena, JBL, Eddie, unfortunately, did feel a little less, not as bad as now, but a little bit less. But anyway, point is Dutch is doing the best he can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's doing a great job.
I know, he's been great. And I wouldn't be surprised at some point if he turns on Swagger and brings in someone else and goes from there. Hopefully they keep him around. And I'm hoping he doesn't slip up and say something old school and stupid and get himself fired.
Yeah, I think he'd be a great. I think he'd be a great commentator.
I don't know if they need him there right now. I think he's best off. I like the manager thing. I think it's a nice sign that they brought him in and that the manager stuff is starting to increase. So
yeah, I'd like to also think that eventually, if they don't need him as a manager, they, you know, he'll go down to Tampa and help the young guys at Full Sail. That'd be a big deal, too.
Yeah, you wonder how much of this was, not that he hasn't earned it, not that he's not, you know, high quality, but you wonder how much of it is just trying to help a guy that just went through a, you know, terrible tragedy.
Well, yeah, that's
just kind of help get his mind off it a little bit.
Yeah, he was in Smoky Mountain for a good stretch, too.
Yep. All right, so there it is, number 27, Dutch Mantel.
Dutch Mantel. Number 26, a guy...
I jumped the gun,
no,
didn't I?
You did jump the gun. I knew you were going to do that. We'll get to him in a minute. You knew he was going to be on the list eventually, but we'll get to him in a sec. Now, number 26 is our first guy that really cut his teeth as a manager in TNA. Really, he didn't really...
No.
Well, no, that's true. I mean, he
no.
did manage WCW, but I liked him more in TNA. I think his TNA managing was better. Come on, let's be honest. I mean, think about the guy. Well, let's go. Number 26 on our list is the... what is it? The sinister minister himself.
Yes.
James Mitchell. Yes, I know he was James Vandenberg in WCW, but let's be honest. We make fun of all that crap every week. So let's not sit here and be like, wow, that Glacier Mortis stuff was awesome. Blood runs cold. It was, but it wasn't. In my opinion, he really, really set himself apart as a great manager when he went to TNA.
I believe it was James Vanderbeek, not James.
Yes. The sinister minister was the quarterback in Varsity Blues. Yes, of course he was.
And but, then the Sinister Mister dated Pacey and had a feud. I mean, dated Joey and had a feud with Pacey.
And had a feud. So, yes, James Mitchell started. Well, let's go back a little bit. He has actually a great. I brought it from our friend Johnny Reckless. He has a great shoot interview. JR.
James Mitchell. Now Lou, nobody called anyone a JT.
No, Mr. Vandenberg, you are not a JT. by any stretch. But yeah, his shoot interview was very good. If you could find it, it's probably on High Spots. But yes, we know that he started in Smoky Mountain, actually. He was Daryl Van Horn. He was managing Prince Karis, a 4,000-year-old mummy.
Yeah, so I remember that from the after mags. And he was always kind of a guy that was meant to be a little off-kilter, a little weird. Went to WCW in 96, and they did the whole Mortal Kombat stuff with Mortis and Glacier, and he was a master of the oddities and human oddities, where he liked to collect these weirdos, and he collected Mortis and Wrath. And I always enjoyed this little subculture feud. I know we've talked about this in the past, but I always thought it was kind of cool the way they just made this like it was almost completely separate from the rest of WCW. And I remember Larry Zbyszko was really put over his character with that whole stuff with the oddities and things like that. So Mitchell stuck around for a while, and then, like you said, went to ECW as the Sinister Minister. That's where that all started. Mm-hmm. He was with Tajiri and Mikey Whipwreck, where they were doing the crazy kind of devil-worshipping stuff. And that's where he became really... He was just like an oddball in WCW. He didn't become like a true like weirdo devil-worshipper until he went to ECW.
Yes, and he was... that was the Unholy Alliance. He was actually feuding with the FBI and your boy Sally Gratz. Part of that big feud there. He actually lost a part of his finger using a fireball shooting machine. And if some people forget, JR, on a side note with ECW, he actually was at One Night Stand in 05. He came out with Whipwreck and Tajiri.
Yes, he did.
So, people remember that. But of course, I think that he really found his legs as a manager. He actually,
I don't know. I mean, he was good in TNA. I just feel like his best was still. It may be his best, but I don't say like his cutting of teeth is. I mean, it didn't wait until TNA for him to break out, I guess is my point.
Well, I just feel
maybe he peaked in TNA, but
maybe he peaked in TNA. I just feel that. I mean, I know you enjoy the Mortis and Wrath stuff, but if you look at the whole global scope of things, it was kind of on the. You're right. It was subterfuge or whatever. Mm. It was kind of on the underground, but he joined TNA pretty much. It wasn't subterfuge.
That's like a. Spying, isn't it? Subterfuge.
Yes, it is. I think your boy Parcells used that in a press conference when he was with the Jets. Anyway, he went to TNA pretty much when they started in 2002. He became Father James Mitchell. Mm-hmm. They were the Disciples of the New Church.
Oh yeah, he had all that good stuff. And then him and Raven, when they shaved Raven's head and chopped them all up. Remember, he was bleeding and it was
all over the place. Yep. Then he left. Came back in 05, and that's the real. Guy that he's most known for in TNA managing, and that's of course Abyss.
Oh, I forget that he was the one with all the brought Abyss in, and when he shot his dad in the head and all that shit.
Yes, but he did. He did help Abyss win the world title in 2006. So
I'll say this about Mitchell: he's old school. He makes everything legitimate, makes everything believable. As asinine and as goofy as the gimmick may be, he really works hard to make it, as legitimate as it can be. And there are actually rumors that he's going to be. They were reaching out to him to come back to WWE right now.
No,
who's he supposed to be involved with? Do you remember? I can't remember now.
I don't remember exactly who, but I know that Vince has been back on the kick of wanting managers. Yeah. He's not the only one. There's another guy they've been talking about because they think the Seb Coulter thing is working very well.
Yeah.
There was another guy that they were thinking about other than, but Mitchell was one of them. I don't know who could he go with. Without it being
Fandango.
Too weird. I'm already hating that. And I love Johnny Curtis, but I'm already hating that. It's not quite reached Kizarni levels of despising, but it's getting pretty close. Just wrestle the fucking match, for God's sakes. 3 weeks now, 3 shows now, and we're doing the whole "you're not saying my name right." And actually, Lillian said it pretty well on SmackDown Friday. But anyway, I think Mitchell is one of those unheralded guys who doesn't get enough credit. But really being a good old school, and you're exactly right, JR. His stuff really put over the feuds and the storylines, and he needs to be given credit for being one of the best managers the last 15, 16 years. So there you go. Number 26 on the list is the Sinister Minister himself, James Mitchell. Now you can play it.
Play what?
Number 25. Go ahead.
Rookie is a little over the line, my man.
Look.
The one good thing, though, about accidentally not playing the right cut is it sounds funny anyway, regardless of whatever you just hit. So, all right. Number 25, JR. Who's...
A guy that, on first glance, you would think should be a lot higher. But as we've documented, Scott, his foray into managing was not the most successful, but... I think just because of the longevity that he had and the characters that he had and the important storylines he was involved in, you had to move him up the list a little bit. Of course, that's the one and only Ted DiBiase. After he retired from the ring in 93, did a little commentary, and then started up his corporation in 94. First guy in should have been the harbinger of things to come. Of course, that was Nikolai Volkov.
Yes.
And from there, he kept building as he had the fake Undertaker. And then it really got going from there when he picked up Bam Bam Bigelow, picked up IRS, Tatanka. And then, of course, Sid. He had the big feud with Sid and Diesel throughout 95. And maybe most famously, besides the 1-2-3 Kids heel turn where he paid him off, was the debuting Steve Austin as a ringmaster. He was associated with him for a while in 96 before he was fired. And then even in 97, you forget, he was pretty much the de facto. I mean, he wasn't maybe a straight up manager, but he was supposed to be the money man behind the NWO. And he did a lot of their mic work early on, and then, of course, managed the Steiners before retiring. So, Ted DiBiase, a guy that had the vocal chops, I think it's a mix of things. One, he just had a kind of a tepid pool of wrestlers in WWF.
That was a problem. The roster was just so thin that, right. I mean, what was he going to do, you know?
And two, I think he was such a great heel that it kind of overshadowed his guys.
Yes, I agree. Of course, JR... Ted DiBiase gave you your first true pay-per-view mark out live moment for you in your little day, your salad days as a wrestling fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
The guy who surprised you as being the commentator for the 94 Rumble.
Yeah, because he'd been gone since August of 93, so no idea he was coming back. But, you know, I have fond memories of the corporation, as goofy as it was, and some of the clowns he had. You know, it is what it is. But, you know, he was the predominant heel manager during that time outside of Jim Cornette. And a guy that was really made out to be a top-level manager. And I think it's a guy that deserved a better fate as a manager.
Yeah, and the problem was he, I think the guy that should have been but wasn't should have been the – he had multiple guys that could have been centerpieces of that corporation. One, of course, was your boy Bam Bam Bigelow. And the other was obviously Sid. But the problem was, you know, the booking was garbage and just everything was in the toilet.
And
so
Kama.
That was.
Don't forget Kama.
And Kama, the Supreme Fighting Machine, yes, melted down the urn into a chain. So there you go. Number 25 on our list of the greatest managers of all time in the PTB world. And that is the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. At number 24, JR.
And
we're
one
go
just
back.
A quick note. Jim Mitchell was rumored to be coming in to manage the Ascension, the NXT team that may be coming up soon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, fantastic team in Florida, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very well talked about. Down
right, let's
Full
gloss
Sail,
over so. This next one pretty quickly here, Scott.
We gotta yes, number 24. Yeah, number 24, old school guy, one of my first favorite managers growing up as a kid, and that was the luscious one, luscious Johnny Valiant. Of course, you know, obviously a former world tag team champion with his brother, the Valiant Brothers. Yeah. I mean, we're going old school. We're really old here. But his guys that he managed were pretty cool. Obviously, one of my brother's favorite early managers because he managed one of my brother's favorite tag teams. And that was the Dream Team of Greg the Hammer Valentine and the Barber. Well, actually, it wasn't Barber. He was the Brutai, Brutus Beefcake, former World Tag Team Champions. He actually managed Hogan in the AWA in the early 80s before, you know, Hogan turned face.
Yep.
And Johnny V threw the cigar ashes in Mike Rotundo's eyes, and that led the U.S. Express to lose to the Dream Team. And, of course, they lost to the Bulldogs. He also managed Dino Bravo.
Oh, yeah, that was when they became the new Dream Team, and then after that he was kind of phased out. And I remember him also as a commentator during that time period. A guy that you'd consider a lower-level manager during the heyday of managers. You know, he had the one tag team gold on his resume. He did a fine job, built heat. I thought he could be a little overbearing at times. Not one of my favorites, but you know, he's serviceable. No serious complaints about him.
Yeah, and he actually introduced Demolition. He introduced Demolition. Obviously, they would be managed by somebody else, who we'll get to in a little bit. And he also, by the way, JR, went to AWA late in the game in 1989, and guess what? Managed your boys, Wayne Bloom and Mike Enos, the Destruction Crew. In the AWA, and actually led them to the world titles in 1989, defeating Greg Gagne and Paul Diamond in a tournament final. Now he's a comedian, he's been on TV, and he's a Pittsburgh guy by nature. Actually grew up, I think he's lived like three blocks away from Bruno or something. But yeah, so there you go. Number 24 on our list of PTB's greatest managers of all time, the luscious one, Johnny Valiant.
And that leads us into number 23, one of the only remaining females. We have two left, and she's one of them. Mm-hmm. It is, of course, Vicky Guerrero. Unbelievably, where she is on this list, you would think it was crazy, you know, 6 or 7 years ago. But ever since she became a manager in this role, when she usurped Teddy Long as GM, and then was associated with Edge, and of course, more recently with Dolph Ziggler, just a heat machine. Say what you want about her. She's got herself into fantastic shape. An older woman with kids on the road traveling, really bust her ass. and really isn't afraid to show show ass and have her ass kicked all over the place. She's been tombstoned and 619'd and everything else under the sun, speared. And here she goes, still ticking, still gaining heat with her excuse me. And, you know, she can be annoying. She can be overbearing at times. But for the most part, she really is a good manager and someone who works hard to get her charges over. You know, Dolph outgrew her for sure. But I don't know if he gets as big with her without her as he did with her.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. I think she's – at this point, I think she's just been on too much. But that's mostly more the GM, you know, debacles that they keep sticking her in. But as a manager, she definitely – and I think she helped Edge. I mean, even – I mean, Edge obviously was over anyway, but it didn't hurt to have him with her.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
You know, and I love that whole crew. They had the whole family with Chavo and
Bam,
you know,
Neely.
7 into 08 and Bam Neely. Bam Neely. God, I miss Bam Neely.
The Edgeheads.
The Edgeheads, obviously Hawkins and Ryder. That was a good little – you know, we were going through those those reviews when we were doing our regular awesome WWE reviews on Bigelow34.proboards.com, which we're on hiatus for the moment because we're in some other endeavors, but we'll go back to it. She was big help, and she took a couple of – she took a 619 from Ray at the Rumble. She took a spear from somebody
on
a wheelchair.
In the wheelchair. She was in the wheelchair.
In the wheelchair, yep.
Did the seated senton onto her.
Yep. So, Vicky definitely deserves her spot. And she is there at number 23 on PTB's Greatest Managers of All Time. Number 22, JR, is easily one of my favorite guys of all time. Finally, that video clip actually leads to something we're talking about for once. That is, of course, one of my favorites, the great Colonel Rob Parker.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Robert Fuller. And this is a guy, JR, not just as a manager, but this guy's been all over the business in his career. He's been a promoter, a booker. He's been a travel guy. He's been everything. Wrestler. Robert
Big in
Fuller,
Alabama. In Tennessee with Jimmy Golden, who had, of course, become Bunkhouse Buck.
Mm-hmm.
They worked down there in the South, and they would reunite in WCW. He also worked AWA. Just a guy who really made the rounds. We heard some good Jimmy Golden, some good Robert Fuller stories from Bruno when he was on with us.
Yes,
and of course in WCW, that's where I first got to know him. Was Colonel Rob Parker introduced Harlem Heat. The clip you just heard, of course, is Booker T, known as Kane and Cole at the time.
Yep.
You can read about that in my Fall Brawl 93 review. Mm-hmm. Just posted on the message board.
Awesome.
Also, of course, managed Sid, and he teamed up with Vader in 93. He had quite the awesome little stud stable. Remember, he had Steve Austin for a little bit in 94. Then he had Bunkhouse Buck, Ming, Dick Slater, Terry Funk, Arn Anderson. He had the whole wedding with Sherry Martel before, of course, they both kind of managed Harlem Heat. Then he had the weird little run with the Amazing French Canadians in 97 as well.
Yeah, remember that? And he started wearing – wasn't he wearing like a beret and all that other weird shit?
No, it was a beret. He was wearing like one of those – I don't know, Canadian hat.
Oh, like the...
With the earmuffs.
Oh, like one of those flap hats.
Yeah, like one of those things.
But, well, look at... I mean, you talked about the stud stable.
It was a French Foreign Legion uniform.
That's right, yeah. Oh, yes, I know what you're talking about now. With the pants, with the, flared out, yeah. You talk about the stud stable in the early 90s. His original stud stable, which I think was in Memphis, was awesome. Probably one of the best... You know, we talk about awesome heel factions, and we'll certainly talk about more of them as we further up the list. But his original stud stable in the early 80s, his brother Ron gave him this idea. And this was one of the cool thing back in those days is this stable would tour from Fed to Fed.
Yep.
Now, how awesome is that? You know, guys bounce around, but an entire stable bounced around. And it was Jimmy Golden, Sid, Cactus Jack, Dirty Dutch, Gary Young, and a young primetime Brian Lee. How about that for a pretty cool faction?
Yeah, definitely.
And those guys were bouncing from full – we're talking full factions moving from promotion to promotion. That's crazy. You never – that's nuts. You know, you never really think about that. But, yeah, that's kind of crazy. But, yeah, Colonel Rob Parker, easily one of the greatest of all time. And, again, you know, this guy's –
of course, don't forget, too, his WWF run briefly in 98 when he was Tennessee Lee. Managed Jeff Jarrett with the Southern Justice, and then he left at the end, went back to Alabama for a while. So,
yes, yeah. So, a guy that does that not doesn't get enough credit, but sometimes a guy that you forget from the early '80s through the late '90s as one of the one of the greatest managers of all time. So, at number 23 on our list of the greatest man. Oh, I'm sorry, number 22 on the greatest managers of all time list here, the Place to Be podcast, Colonel Rob Parker.
Number 21, of course, a guy that I catch a lot of shit for my opinions of, but still very deserving of his ranking on this list, and is the one and only Mr. Fuji. Longtime wrestler, tag team champion, transitioned to being a manager in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. Most known for managing Demolition, of course, taking over from Luscious Johnny V. Then he transitioned to the Powers of Pain, one of the stupidest managerial moves of all time.
I know.
Leaving the champions for the unproven challengers. Managed them for a while, and then they split up, and he went to the Orient Express. Was with them for a while. And then, of course, would eventually hook up with Yokozuna, bringing him the most fame. Don't forget the Berserker as well, his quick run.
Yes.
There. And, of course, with Yokozuna was his biggest run when he was world champion. Thoughts on Mr. Fuji? Because I know we debated this a little bit. I think you thought he belonged a little higher.
I understand why you can't, why you don't like him, because he's one of those guys who never really did much. Yeah, and he never did anything to help a guy win a match, really.
Yeah, he cost more matches than he won.
Yeah, his cane would always get stolen. Like, I get. But I think his comedic heel sense, I think, stepped to the fore a little bit earlier on in the 80s than most people remember. Of course, he did those awesome Fuji kind of short movies with Morocco, and him and Morocco. He was trying to get Morocco like a movie deal, so it was Fuji Vice, Fuji Medical, General for Fuji General, and what was the other one? There were three of them. Fuji Vice, Fuji General, and I can't think of the third one.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, I can't think of the third one, but they did like these little shorts. They were on TNT every week for like 5 months in 1985.
Yeah, him and Morocco were definitely a highlight in the
80s. Yeah, they were very funny. Yeah, I think a lot of people wonder what the hell. I mean, obviously they were trying to turn, you know, Demolition face, and they really didn't do a very good job of siphoning Fuji off. What they should have done was had him lose. They should have had Demolition lose to the Powers of Pain, and then Fuji turns on him. And Fuji goes with them instead of just leaving for the hottest team in the promotion for the unproven guys. Right. Yeah, that made no sense. I think that was kind of I think they were painted into a corner because they wanted to siphon the heel manager off the about to be hot face team. But I understand where you're coming
Fuji,
from.
Fuji Bandito was the third one.
Fuji Bandito. I mean, I knew it was one. I had the little short in my head. I knew it was like some kind of cowboy western thing. And so Fuji Bandito, Fuji General, and Fuji Vice. Fuji Vice was really the worst one. Worst in terms of them actually trying to be serious, but really it's the funniest one. And then there's one where they're walking around, you know, Hollywood trying to. And he looked out of. What made it great, though, JR, he was so out of place. Like, you know, Morocco's trying to be all this suave. You got this dumb guy with a stupid tuxedo and a goofy hat and a cane. It was just so. That's what made it funny. So I think comedically, I think you need to give him a little more credit. But no, maybe base manager. He really didn't become a very important guy until he hooked up with Yokozuna.
And even my argument, he wasn't the main manager of Yokozuna. He was, you know, portrayed as someone who couldn't get Yoko over the hump until he had assistance from another manager.
Yeah, right.
He's fine for what he was. He was always portrayed the devious Mr. Fuji, but. I always feel like Gorilla compensated for things. Like, he'd say, like, oh, look at Mr. Fuji, you know, coming up with advice on how to beat, you know, how his charge can beat this guy. And he's just standing there with this dumb look on his face at ringside. You know, it's like, what, is he really doing these things that Gorilla says he is?
Yeah.
Other managers, you just believe more are managers. And Fuji, could you picture Fuji booking Yokozuna's travel plans and setting up his matches? I don't know.
Yes, I know.
Never believable.
You will face Ron Cumberledge.
Yeah, this was very, I don't know, just a guy I never fully got into, but he's a vintage classic manager and one of the guys who cannot obviously leave off this list. And I'm sure we're going to hear a little bit of flack maybe for having him too low, but bring it on. This is just where I believe he belongs.
Okay. All right. Another one of my personal favorites, again, from the kind of the territory years, at number 20 on our list, and that is, he's got plenty of names. Some of you newer WWE fans know him as General Adnan. I knew him as Sheik Adnan L. Casey. This guy managed a boatload of dudes, more guys than I think anybody ever realized. What's crazy is, here's a little known fact, he was in the same graduating high school class. I don't know if I'd admit this to many people, but he was in the same graduating high school class as Saddam Hussein.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was in Baghdad. So he is Iraqi. He is an Iraqi. He is from Baghdad.
Yep.
So, again, I know we're trying not to do too many bios, but we're some of these older guys. Yeah. It doesn't hurt to just at least kind of see their journey quickly. He started New Japan, actually, in the early 70s as the Sheik of Sheiks of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Him and Nikolai Volkov were a tag team. And, you know, wrestled guys like Inoki and Seiji Sakaguchi and guys like that. Then in 1981, he would go to the AWA. This is really where he would, shine as a manager. He wanted to take the win the title from Nick Bockwinkel, failed at that, so he got in Jerry Blackwell, you know, the big fat dude with the beard. And then in his pre-Creamy Legs years, he was managing Ken Patera.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody else was managing Ken Patera. I wonder who.
Mm.
We'll get to him later. Blackwell and Patera actually won the AWA tag titles from the High Flyers. And, then on that huge AWA Super Sunday, which was the same day as that infamous Bockwinkel Hogan match. He teamed with Blackwell in a tag team match against Vern Gagne and Mad Dog Vachon. He also teamed with Boris Zukov against the Midnight Rockers. He managed King Kong Brody because, God forbid, the guy's name could be Bruiser, like anybody knows who the fuck he was. Another guy that managed the Berserker there, JR.
Yes, Nord the Barbarian.
At the time, he was Nord the Barbarian. Kokina, King Tonga, and the Mongolian Stomper.
And Boris Zukov. And then, of course, in 1990, he jumped to WWF.
Yep.
Probably his most infamous role as General Adnan, managing Sergeant Slaughter and eventually Colonel Mustafa, well known as the Iron Sheik. And this feud was fantastic early on. He had tons of heat, and I thought he was fantastic in this role. You know, Slaughter's a great talker, but Adnan added that a little extra oomph to him, a little more believability that Slaughter would have jumped ship over to Iraq. I think by adding Adnan to the mix, and he's always yelling, and supporting Saddam Hussein and speaking, you know, Iraqi or Iraqi, is that the language?
Iraq.
Ignorant.
Farsi or whatever. Yeah, I don't know. Something like that. Arab.
And of course, he was great to build the heat up until WrestleMania 7 when they're burning the flag, or they wanted to burn the flag, but they burned the Hulkamania shirt and debuted the Saddam Hussein boots and all that stuff. And he was just really good in that role. And he stuck around until right after 92. He was still managing Colonel Mustafa in early 92. So, a guy that maybe isn't on everyone's radar, but he had a lot of good work in AWA and one of the bright spot managers in that period from late 90 to early 92. He had a great year in 91, really. And you can argue, you know, Bobby Heenan was fading away and Jimmy Hart wasn't, you know, too much on the radar. You can argue, General Adnan is one of the, General Adnan, to me, is one of the, could be arguably the manager of the year in WWF in 1991.
I concur, because again, a lot of guys were fading away and he was a nasty bastard, I'll tell you. And but yeah, his run in AWA in the mid to late 80s was second to none. Feuded with a bunch of guys, and obviously when Bobby left, AWA and went to the WWF, obviously kind of Adnan kind of took over for him as the top heel manager in the AWA. So definitely a guy that deserves a lot of credit and put over a lot of guys, particularly guys like Jerry Blackwell, who trying to watch his matches is tough. So there you go, number 20 on our list of PTB's greatest managers of all time. General Adnan. JR, next up, guy number 19 is a guy kind of similar to Mr. Adnan.
And that is, of course, Skandor Akbar.
Yes.
Started out as a wrestler in 1960s and became a manager in 1977, pretty much all through Texas. Also hit up Mid-South a little bit, always smoking the cigar, if you remember.
Yep.
Managed the Von Erich as a fan favorite. Then he turned. And Akbar, of course, one of the main heels. Always throwing fireballs and harassing the fans and doing whatever he could down world class.
Yes, and he, unlike General Adnan, he is not a natural born Arab. He's from Texas. So,
Devastation Inc.
Devastation Incorporated. That was probably one of the coolest, next to Stud Stable, one of my first coolest favorite heel faction names, Devastation Incorporated. And let me tell you something, what a bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm.
Let me kind of go peruse here very quickly. Let's see. Do I have to click the dev? I might have to click the link. Oh no, they don't have one. But if I remember correctly, he's got a full list here. I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'm trying to think of the guys who are Devastation Incorporated. I think Gary Young, Kabuki, who used to scare the shit out of me as a kid. Kabuki, who the fuck else was there? I think Hercules might have been in that. I think Hercules was in that group. Jesse Barr, guy we've talked about often. I think Kamala, maybe? Yeah, I mean, it was a bunch
of... Here's a list of everyone who was ever in Devastation, Inc. Abdullah the Butcher, Steve Austin, Cactus Jack, Greg Valentine, One Man Gang, The Punisher, Ted DiBiase, Al Perez, Dusty Rhodes, Dick Murdoch, Brickhouse Brown, Black Bart, Butch Reed, Kamala, King Kong Bundy, Nord the Barbarian, and The Terminator.
Dusty was a Devastation Incorporated?
I guess so. Maybe in the very, very beginning.
Wow. Kind of, yeah. He, other guys he's managed, Al Perez.
I mean, yeah, all these sites, they'll include anyone that was.
Well, yeah, yeah, that stood next to him on a camera shot, yeah. Wild Man Bill Irwin, Al Perez, Big Bubba Rogers. Of course, we know as Big Boss Man. He managed Brutus. He managed Beefcake.
Missing Link as well.
Yep, Brickhouse Brown, Buddy Landell, Dick Murdoch. And this guy had a pretty good crew of dudes in his career from beginning to end. So easily one of the most star-laden resumes of a manager that we have on this list, Skandor Akbar. And again, managed one of the coolest factions ever, Devastation Incorporated. Bundy was a big guy in that group, too. Mm-hmm. I think I mentioned Bundy. He was kind of – Sheik Adnan, he was to World Class what Adnan was to AWA. He was that, like, anchor manager. Now, they were obviously never the number one heels in the company. Number one heels in the company were always the Freebirds.
Right.
But the number two group of heels was always Devastation Incorporated. Now, I mean, mind you, they feuded with the Von Erichs mostly when titles were involved. And the Von Erichs, when they weren't feuding with titles, usually feuded with, you know, Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy and those guys. But anytime belts were involved, usually it involved Devastation Incorporated. So those were the highlights of those early World Class years, JR, is watching Devastation Incorporated. Great, great heel faction and a good manager. Guy cut great promos. Yeah, he was awesome. So definitely we're playing the Iraqi national anthem. What's that? At number 19 on our list of the greatest managers of all time, Skandor Akbar. Number 18, easily a PTB fan favorite.
I can't believe it. I can't go anywhere without the bright lights, television cameras, but I don't blame you. I mean, after all, everybody's talking about the hottest album in the country right now, Power Drive, rapping the album.
Of course, there's an infamous interview with your next man, promo, where he's eating buckets of fried chicken. Did you ever question the taste of the WWF in the mid to late 80s?
I'm surprised was he sitting off was he standing off in the foreground when Iron Sheik called JYD a dirty black dog?
Of course, that is the one and only, the Doctor of Style, Slick Baby.
Slick Baby. Brother! Slick is awesome.
Yeah.
Came in at the right time. As a guy that's going to be, he's right next on the list, a guy who was retiring, and Slick took his guys and filled his cachet and had some really awesome awesome guys in his stable.
Don't forget, too, though, he started in Central States in Kansas City, mainly with Butch Reed, and they were forced to lose after losing a Loser Leaves Town match to Bruiser Brody. So that's why him and Reed came together to the WWF, and then, of course, like you said, he picked up some other guys like Nikolai Volkoff and the Iron Sheik. But most successfully, it's probably with the one-man gang, summer of 88, transitioned to the one and only, the great African Dream, Akeem. Big Boss Man was brought in and became the Twin Towers, and that's where Slick probably had his greatest run as far as level, I guess, push, when they feuded with the Mega Powers into 1989. And then from there, he managed a wide variety, Power and Glory, The Warlord towards the end, Rick Martel for a brief run, and of course, like we said, Butch Reed early on. So after he was power slammed by Davey Boy Smith in late 91, he came back as a face, managed Kamala, and became a reverend, and then retired from the wrestling game. It still pops up every now and then when they do old school stuff. But one of my favorites growing up and to this day, just a guy who really personifies that era of wrestling.
Yes, and managed, as you said, one of your favorite tag teams of all time, and that is, of course, the Twin Towers. What was it about them you liked? Was that your early stretch of awesome Haas teams right there?
Who? Power and Glory?
Twin Towers.
Oh, Twin Towers? Oh, yeah.
Power and Glory. Power and Glory.
They're one of my favorite teams, too.
You're making sure. I know. you're making sure you're going to find Billy What's-His-Name? Is that who you're looking for?
I just want to make sure I get the right team.
Yeah, Power and Glory. Would you say they were your first favorite tag team, the Twin Towers?
No, because when I started wrestling, they had just broken up. So I didn't really get to love them until I went back and watched stuff. So Rockers are actually probably my first favorite tag team, but I liked Power and Glory immediately, too. So Slick was involved in my early tag team love. Yeah. Just a guy synonymous with that, like I said, with that era, and having the feud with Hogan, with, you know, Boss Man and also Akeem off to the side was big for him. And for a while there, you could argue he was the biggest manager in the promotion in late 89 or late 88 into early 89 for that May 6 month run with the Boss Man and Hogan feud. So, you know, a guy that's really left a memorable mark, had a lot of great guys in a stable, and just a cool manager.
Yes. So there you go. Number 18 on our list of the PTB greatest managers of all
time.
Turn
out the lights. The party's over.
Remember that awesome promo with him and the Warlord against Bulldog?
I'll never forget it, my friend.
That's right. One of the most awesome of all time. David Boy! So now at number 17 on our list, JR, is the guy that Slick replaced on the in the canon of awesome WWF managers of the day. And of course, this guy is an icon.
Yeah.
And he's probably one of the most revered guys. He's one of those guys in the WWF history you don't really say many bad things about. And that is, of course, the fashion plate of professional wrestling at number 17. Who is it, JR?
Classy Freddie Blassie.
Yep.
And of course, now you're
obviously,
you know,
based on your pictures on Facebook, your daughter's favorite manager.
Yes. And Blassie, of course, if this were an all-time manager list, would be way up there. But of course, by 1983, he was starting to wind down a little. And the reason it's as high as he is because he actually managed tag team champions during the stretch. Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff, of course, upset the U.S. Express at WrestleMania 1 to win the gold. And he, you know, had that one last run with Glory and was still, you know, name dropped as a top manager even into 86 when he finally gave way to Slick. But from 83 to 86, still one of the, you know, top guys manager-wise. And, of course, before that was one of the three major along with Grand Wizard and another one we'll get to later. So I think Blassie is a guy, you know, tough to rank when you're just looking at 83 on. And I hope we're honoring him by putting him at least this high, even though, you know, he only had a three-year run.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. Obviously, as a wrestler, Blassie is well known for his legendary West Coast feud with John Tolos, you know, world title matches all over the place in California and Oregon and, you know, all over the West Coast and blood everywhere. And he used to lick it off his opponent's forehead. It was crazy. He was a lunatic. And obviously he was one of Hulk Hogan's first managers, but yeah, unfortunately our criteria for this list was starting in the little slightly before the pay-per-view era. And as you mentioned, he was just getting older. This is it's not his fault. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He just was, you know, he was in his, you know, late 50s, early 60s by that point.
Yep.
Of course, died in 2003 at the age of 85. Trivia question for you, JR. What was the last thing that Classy Freddie Blassie said on WWE television?
Oh, jeez. Get the tables?
Correct. D-Von, get the tables.
I win the trivia contest. We don't have to have this year.
We don't have to have it this year.
All right, that Scott, let's hit number 16, and then we'll take a break. We'll be halfway through. Well, more than halfway through.
More than halfway through. At number 16 on our list, a guy, one of the few guys on this list who is just as good as a great manager. Of course, he's transitioned from an awesome Hall of Fame wrestler, and he is a Hall of Fame wrestler, and that is, of course, former 7-time World Heavyweight Champion. I'll say it the way that I just lost it. His name just totally fell out of my head. The announcer from Florida, Dr. G's guy, I can't think of his name. You never like him. What the heck is his name? Oh, my God.
Gordon Solie?
Gordon Solie, thank you. Harley Race. I used to call him Harley. Harley Race, of course, number 60 on our list, and because he probably managed one of the – I mean, I know this guy was big, you know, just on his own. But really, you got to give Harley a lot of credit for just making Vader awesome.
Yeah, but before Vader, he even managed or was the advisor with Lex Luger.
Yes.
In 1991, when he joined in after retiring from active competition. So he was with Luger when he was world champion. And, of course, it was during Luger's feud with Ron Simmons when he uttered the infamous promo, "When I was world champion, I had a boy like you to carry my bags."
Carry my bags!
And that was all part of the strategy to build support for Simmons. And that would, of course, backfire. But so he, of course, after That run with Luger, like you said, he managed Vader, and that was probably where he's most notable as a manager. Had a great run with Vader, and he was a badass when he was a Vader. He took some crazy bumps even at that point, and really became, you know, one with Vader. They came synonymous with each other all throughout 93 and 94, and to me, just a tough guy manager, more of a... this is a guy that was more of an advisor. Just, you know, he wasn't a little pussy that had to be backed up by his muscle. He was a guy that could stand toe to toe with anyone else. He was just an older guy that had retired, but he was really positioned as just, you know, tough as nails still, even as a manager. And I loved him with Vader. I thought it was one of the greatest manager wrestler pairings ever.
Yes, and Harley is remembered for being in a lot of memorable places. Throughout his career, I did not know this. He was the last person that Owen Hart talked to before putting on the harness at Over the Edge 99. Harley was backstage, and Owen told him, "I'm not really crazy about this thing you're putting on." But Owen, of course, as Owen is, said, "Don't worry about it, Harley. Everything's good." And we all know what happened. Anyway, but yeah, I mean, and the backstage guys love him. I mean, we're talking about a guy who, and of course, he's tough as a $2 list. I'll tell you something. I saw him in October. At the con, the Legends of the Ring convention in Monroe, which of course is returning to Monroe in June, and he's still, I mean, yeah, he walks slow, but you know, tell you, I wouldn't fuck with him. I'll tell you right now. And Vader tried to, and I think Vader got the shit kicked out of him by him. So, still at 80, what is he now? 80? Maybe he's not that old yet.
No, he was Harley born in. He's 69.
He's 69. Yeah. But obviously, he's, you know, when you've been wrestling that long, you know, your back goes. He had hip placement. That's why he had to retire from the being a manager even altogether in 95. He had a car accident. But yeah, the guy's tough as a $2 steak and will always go down as one of the greatest of all time. And made, you know, at a time, I'll tell you something, at a time when everybody thought Lex Luger's career was about to be flushed on the toilet in 1991, Harley kind of saved him.
Yeah.
Because obviously, you know, at that moment, you know, Lex's career was dirt. His reputation was garbage. You know, after the whole Flair thing leaving, and Flair didn't want him to job it to Wyndham and all this other stuff, Harley kind of saved his bacon at that time and kind of got him back on track.
Oh, yeah, he definitely added some legitimacy. Yeah,
some legitimacy, and then he added, and of course, Vader. So there you go, number 16 on our list of PTB's greatest managers of all time, the great Harley Race. All right, so there we go. Why don't we take a quick break, and then we'll give you the top 15. We'll recap this part of the list, and then we will do the top 15. Of course, many of your favorites still up there, and obviously there's a lot of guys you know are going to be on here, and we can't wait to get to them. This is Manager Listomania. 15 and up coming up next. But first, a word. Because.
Pencil Night Geek.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What I'd like to have right now.
Chad, do you ever feel that the world revolves around WWF?
I think you mean WWE there, Barf.
Yeah, whatever, but what about David Crockett?
He likes it! Well, what about Jimmy Valiant?
I'm gonna get you all until I get you, Paul Jones. Oh.
The Four Horsemen.
We are a family, and we are the best.
The Omni, the Dangerous Alliance.
Please welcome the newest members of the Dangerous Alliance, Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko.
Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express.
The Fantastics are putting the U.S. Tag Team title on the line against the Midnight Express.
Main events with actual work rate in them.
Woo! 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 All right!
It's just not fair to Flair.
It's not fair for Flair.
If this is what you're looking for, please check out Where the Big Boys Play podcast, the only pure NWA and WCW supercard podcast out there.
While you were in Hollywood making movies, Thunder Lips, I was winning world titles.
So a guy from across the pond and a dude from the south, Where the Big Boys Play. It's a great podcast. Harv and Chad are awesome. Check them out. Also, check out WrestleChat.net, indeed where it's at. Great message board, plenty of topics to browse, the Still Real to Us podcast, and much, much more. Also, our message board, which is awesome, Bigelow34.proboards.com. It's where PTB really began. Written reviews and a boatload of them in PTB Nation. We have you to thank for that. Plus the territory wars, a whole lot more. If you want a one-touch spot for our show, you can head there. Also, head to Stitcher.com and the Stitcher app for all phones and tablets, and more details on that. Also, our good friend Graham Cawthon, History of WWE.com, the best research site you will ever find. Also, another sponsor to the show, the Wrestling Forum, TWFnews.com, their wrestling forum, a blog site, much, much more. The guys at TWF creating a wrestling media nation, many blogs, podcasts, and vodcasts. Yours could be included at the official forum of WrestleChat.net and the place to be. We've joined up as well. So check them out, find out what they're about at TWFnews.com. Also, you can check out our show at GetThePointRadio.com. My good friend Mike, it's a great online radio station. If you're not in the mood for wrestling, but you want to listen to music, pop it on. He plays music all day long. But you can also check his archive on iTunes, and all of our shows are there as well. Big site.
Hello, everybody. This is Bruno Lauer. I'm on The Place to Be. You're listening to The Place to Be podcast. And I'm going to tell you something right now. If you didn't know about our business, this is The Place to Be. The Place to Be podcast. You know why? Because it's like Mama says, it be that way sometimes.
All right, Nation, we are back from break, counting down the top 34 wrestling managers since 1983, yep. As requested by Mike Rude. We are at number 15.
15. Very quickly, let's recap.
No, this isn't, no one's missed anything. They've heard everything.
All right, go ahead.
Number 15.
You don't have to say it like that. Jesus, I'm just, God.
Because I would have bet any dollar amount that you were going to try and do this radio recap bullshit. Everyone
my
knows
God. All right, all right. My God, can't you just say okay?
Everyone knows
on?
The fucking list.
Do you have to fucking babble about it? Can't you just move on?
Now, don't you talk to me about babbling. All right, here's number 34 through number 16.
All right.
Number 15.
Let's do number 15.
Number 15.
Yes.
The one and only, the great Mr. Perfect.
Yes.
Manager of the equally as great Ric Flair, his advisor in 1991, 1992. That's pretty much it for his run as a manager.
Well, but you know what was great about it, though? He went full bore into it, though.
Oh, yeah.
You would have thought, obviously, the back injury in 91, you would have thought he would have half-assed it, you know, like, oh, I got to fucking do this shit because I can't wrestle. But no, he obviously had a chance to work with one of his favorites, obviously Ric Flair. So he jumped all over being in that role. And loved every minute of it. So
yeah, and he was a dick, man. he was a real asshole.
He was a real asshole. He relished it.
Especially that WrestleMania 8 match with Savage just
fucking
with him the whole match. And just, you know, him and Flair together was just something special. And they worked very well together. He was, you know, believable and intense. And, of course, the whole great stuff at SummerSlam 92 with the, you know, what corner was he going to be in and the perfect plan. And it's really portrayed as a super smart guy. I mean, to be portrayed as a guy that's leading Ric Flair, you're going to be pretty fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Mr. Perfect was in this role. And he was my first real, you know, one of my favorite managers when I started watching at that time. And just great in the role. Really perfect manager.
Yeah. No, he was. It was. And again, he's one of the few guys that would be this high on the list with only one guy in his resume.
Right. And I mean, he was always, you know, reference to someone who played a big role in Flair's title reign. So to me, that gives him extra points.
Yep, exactly.
You know, that he was portrayed as maybe Flair wouldn't be the champ without him at that point.
Exactly. So number 15 on our list, PTB's greatest managers of all time, is one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, Hall of Famer, Mr. Perfect. At number 14 on our list is a guy who younger fans may not think of as a manager because you only know him as one position, and that is the general manager of SmackDown. But at number 14 on our list is the great Teddy Long. And you think, well, Teddy never managed anybody except Mark Henry and what's his name? Red Dog there. whatever his name was there.
Rodney Mack.
Rodney Mack, yeah. But no, Teddy Long had much better guys than any of them.
Yep.
Throughout his career, he was, he obviously he's an NWA guy.
He's a referee at first.
He was a referee in NWA with that god-awful skullet.
Peanut head.
He was peanut head. At the Chi-Town Rumble pay-per-view, he was the replacement referee when Ricky Steamboat won the world title in Chicago. He began to turn into a villainous character. He kind of took the whole Danny Davis thing, and he began to bend the rules for heels. At the Clash of the Champions 6, made a fast count with Mike Rotunno and Dr. Death to defeat the Road Warriors of the world titles. Then, of course, he was fired. Again, pretty much stealing the Danny Davis storyline. It was a story lifted from Florida where Teddy had been a referee there and did the same thing.
Okay.
So they did it again.
And so, of course, after long car rides, a couple of wrestlers, Eddie Gilbert and Kevin Sullivan, heard long talk. And they convinced JR, Jim Ross, to give him a managerial role. Started managing Norman the Lunatic, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, was associated with Doom. And that's where he had his most success, I think, as a manager, with guiding them to the tag titles. He also managed Johnny B. Badd when he first came in as a heel. The Skyscrapers, he was great with them. And then had a run of lower to mid-card jobbers.
Oh, my God. It really got bad at the end there, didn't it?
Yeah, Mags, Joey Mags, Craig Pittman, Jim Sergeant Powers, Craig Bobby Pittman. Walker, Ice Train.
Ice Train.
Yeah, a lot of scrubs. So But during his peak with the Skyscrapers and with Doom were his peak, and he was definitely a top manager during that late 89 period, really portrayed as a stud along with Doom.
Yes, and yes, he would come to the World Wrestling Federation in 1998, would be mostly, for the most part, a manager.
Yeah, referee, I mean.
I mean, a referee. He'd be manager after that. He was another guy who was supposed to be – it's funny how we're in this vein all of a sudden. He was, of course, in Kansas City that night, and he actually reffed the match after Owen Hart fell, which was the infamous Jeff Jarrett. Might as well change his name to that. It wouldn't have mattered at that point. Jeff Jarrett, Deborah, and Val Venus, Nicole mm-hmm. Bass, which, of course, they were pretty much going through the motions. He was also in the ring when Draz got paralyzed. So
he saw a lot.
Saw a lot, yeah. You could see him. He's warning, looking at the paramedics as they lift Draz up on the stretcher. Mm-hmm. And, of course, as I was talking about Rodney Mack earlier, he was most notable in 2003 when he was managing D'Lo Brown, Rodney Mack, Chris Nowinski, Rosie, Mark Henry, and Jazz all at different times, telling fans to get down with the Brown. And
yeah, I liked the Teddy little heel run there he had before becoming GM. I thought he was thugging and bugging and all that stuff, and it was fine. It never recaptured the glory of the late 80s, but a guy that still around today with the company in a prominent role. So he's had a long, lengthy career, and by all accounts, is a great guy, and you can see why he's stuck around as long as he has. So this is your number 14, Mr. Theodore R. Long.
Yes.
And now, Scott, we reach the gross number 13.
The unlucky 13.
Well, that didn't surprise me a bit, because Lou Albano is a big, fat, sloppy pig.
Yes, Captain Lou Albano checks in at number 13. Most
took
of his...
a lot for you.
A lot of his success as well, like Freddie Blassie, came earlier. But he was had still quite the run here after 83, of course, managed the British Bulldogs to the tag team. After they won the tag team title.
Yes.
Right when they were on the cusp of winning, he jumped ship.
Oh, wow, really?
I know, fucking shocker. So he, of course, managed them, and then later in the 90s, he managed the Head Shrinkers, the tag team gold as well. George Steele he was associated with for a while. So, yeah.
And he technically managed the U.S. Express, so we kind of glommed onto them, too. Really, he was not managing the Head Shrinkers. Sika was managing the Head Shrinkers. Lou Albano was nothing more than a fat, sloppy hanger-on. Obviously,
Afa was managing the Head Shrinkers.
The other Head Shrinker. The other Samoan, I'm sorry. Afa was really the manager of the Head Shrinkers. You're going to play the other one from the album.
Oh, the one he sings? No, thanks.
Yeah. George Luis Basquiat Albano.
Oh, God. So, yeah, Albano, of course, was one of the triumvirate of managers, like we mentioned before, with Grand Wizard and Classy Freddie Blassie. Still hung around for a while. One of Vince's guys that would always, one day they loved each other, the next day they hated each other.
I'm just reminded of, I think Jesse said something, he's got a mouthful of macaroni. It's a great line on the album after he sang that song.
I liked him best on Super Mario Brothers more than I did as a manager in the company. Yes. But yes, Lou Albano checks in at number 13, the big fat sloppy pig, to me best known as chomping down on chocolate pumpkins on the Halloween special.
Yes, and sticking his face in.
Not one of my favorites, as you can tell. You know why? The hatred built in 93 and 94 when he came back to the Head Shrinkers and they defeated the Quebecers. To me, that sealed the fate of Captain Lou in my mind, why I continuously did not like him.
So you would not watch a 1978 house show that would have Albano and Mr. Fuji wrestle each other?
Nope. Yep.
With Frenchie Martin?
Nope.
All right. At number 12 on our list, easily It talked about Sunny. Maybe I'm going to amend this. We talked about Sunny earlier, but this one, probably the greatest female manager of all time. And that is, of course, and because she's also a former great wrestler as well. And that is the late, it's very sad when she passed away, but the late, great, Sensational Sherry.
Oh, yeah.
Going back to when she was wrestling in AWA.
Well, this is the manager stuff, so don't forget now. Yeah, she had a great run as a women's wrestler, but it wasn't until she hooked up with Randy Savage in 89 where she started off as a manager.
Yep.
And it was tough feeling, you know, taking over for Liz. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
And at first they portrayed her as really this, you know, crazed, whacked out witch. I don't know what she was supposed to be with the cauldron and everything else.
Yep.
But after a while she kind of find her role a little bit more with Savage. And of course, once he became king, she became Sensational Queen Sherry. That's probably what she's best known as, with the feud with Dusty Rhodes and Sapphire, who's coming up on this list.
Oh, God. Yeah, right.
Probably not. Of course, she was with Savage until he lost the retirement match at WrestleMania 7, and then she joined up with Ted DiBiase. That was a quick run. And then she had a great run with Shawn Michaels, where he was her boy toy. She sang his theme song, turned face, had the cat fight with Luna Vachon, had a brief run in ECW, and then kind of reinvented herself in WCW. Managed Harlem Heat for a while on and off, and Sister Sherry, she had a great run there. They won, you know, 8 million tag team titles with her. So Sherry, Sensational Queen Sherry, Sensational Sherry, Scary Sherry. Don't forget she was also with Ric Flair in WCW before Harlem Heat. So yeah, Sherry, I think, earned the spot. And in addition to being a great manager and portrayed as more than a valet, she was really a straight up manager. She took a lot of bumps for a woman. I mean, guys would beat the piss out of her, especially Hogan. Was always smacking her around.
Yeah.
And she took some nasty bumps for being a woman in Atlanta Giants and the WWF in the early 90s. So someone that always worked her ass off and was a good promo, and I thought she fit really well. How would you rank her charges in WWF, the three guys? Not in historical. I mean, just her runs with them, you know, who she fit best with. And
I would do DiBiase third.
Yep.
Shawn second, Savage first.
Yeah, I think that's fitting. DiBiase, she just wasn't with that long. I mean, well, she was, because she joined with him at WrestleMania 7 and left right around Rumble 92. So it was a while, but he just didn't seem to do much. That was a stretch.
He really didn't need her, you know?
She was good with the Virgil feud a little bit, but yeah, it was just more to give her something to do. And then with Shawn, she became, again, more of an active participant for the year she was with him. So Sensational Sherry, I think, very fitting number 12 entry.
Yes.
Number 11... there's a guy whose voice you hear every couple weeks pop up here on the Place to Be podcast. That is the one and only Mr. Harvey Whippleman, Downtown Bruno. I don't think we need to spend too much time on him, because you heard it all when he was on with us. And we'll direct you to listen to those podcasts. You can go to our archive, placetobe.podcast.podbean.com. And Downtown Bruno, hell of a career. He was all over the place down in the South. And then, of course, came to the WWF in 1991 along with Big Bully Busick, one of my favorites. Was with Sid, Kamala, Giant Gonzalez, Mr. Hughes, well done. He was really the low card manager. You know, you can't tell him that, but that's what he was.
Oh God, that was great. You know what? You know why I love working with you, JR? Because you're just as bad as Rotella in taking the lowest common denominator team and making them sound great. Do you realize how you just said, "Well done"?
Hey, well, they were great.
Like they were number one. Like they were number one contenders or something. You know?
Is it more sad that I could reel off the scrubs that he managed off the top of my head? I didn't even need to look at
that. That might be even worse. But we love Harvey. Bruno's awesome. Bruno's awesome.
Still around today, working backstage. If you haven't listened to our podcast with him, we're going to take a minute to plug it, because he tells an unbelievable story about the night Joey Morello was killed in the car crash, because he was in the car with him.
Yeah.
Emotional story, and he really goes into the full detail. So if you have not heard that interview, go back and listen to it. Of course, the man once known as Dr. Leonard Spazinski, Downtown Bruno / Harvey Whippleman, awesome guy. He was so much fun to talk to. So I think we'll leave it at that. Very fitting here, a guy that had more of a career than you may ever realize when you think back to his time in the Indies. If you're a fan of the Indies and the territories of the 80s, I suggest you go back and listen to that interview.
Yes, I concur. I concur. So, Harvey Whippleman, Downtown Bruno, number 11 on our list. All right, we have reached the top 10 of our manager listomania here on the Place to Be podcast. And kind of a sad moment here as we hit the top 10. At number 10 on our list is a guy who recently left us way too soon. Passed away at the age of 58 last week. And many people feel, again, many younger fans feel they only managed one guy, but far from it. Of course, we're talking about the great Percival Pringle, Dr. Rigor Mortis. And of course, everyone has Dr. Rigor Mortis. And of course, everyone knows him as the great Paul Bearer, Bill Moody.
Best known as the MWF president.
Yes, NWF North or South?
North.
Winner of the big debate. I wanted to take that guy with the cane and just hit him.
Sad, because he was, I think we mentioned this last week in the show, but he was, you know, they had that event scheduled to have lunch with him the day of the show last Saturday, so he just passed away right before that. But, you know, we wanted to save talking about him a little bit till tonight because we thought it would be fitting. Mm-hmm. Like you said, just a guy you may not realize, the depth of a career he had down south in Florida and world class as Percival Pringle, like you said, Percy. Managed Rick Rude, Steve Austin, Mark Calloway early on, Lex Luger, Eric Embry, Ultimate Warrior, just all different guys he's associated with. He had a great gimmick and a completely different gimmick than the one most people know him as, and that was Paul Bearer. Joined in December 90, he signed on, but of course was February 91, he was hooked up with The Undertaker. Brother Love, of course, brought him in, and just memorable from there, of course. Had a great run before he turned on him at SummerSlam 96, hooked up with Mankind, brought in Kane eventually, and then just traded back and forth between Taker and Kane for most of the rest of the decade. Had a quick run in TNA, back in WWE in 2004 before they buried him in cement. Came back again with Kane and Edge during that feud. Don't forget, and then Kane finally finished him off for good when he pushed him off a ladder when he was in a wheelchair, whatever the hell he was in. It killed him off for good on TV. So a guy that really was always dedicated to the business, would do anything it took to get a storyline over. Just a big fan, and a guy, sadly, who I think you know, battled so many weight problems. He had the surgery, and then he put the weight back on. And then once his wife passed away from cancer in 2009, it seemed like he was maybe never the same. I think he was pretty depressed and pretty upset over that. Yeah. And I don't think he ever really recovered from that, it doesn't seem like. No, they were married since 1978. She passed away in 2009, so a long time, 30 years of marriage.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very sad, very sad. And you and I had the pleasure of being in the seeing him live.
Yeah.
Last year at the NWF show, and then we got to see him, you know, cut promos while eating some Kung Pao chicken at the awesome Kowloon's. Paul Bearer really, I don't know if the Undertaker would have gotten over as well with any other guy. You couldn't have just a run of the with a character like Undertaker. Mm. You couldn't just have a run-of-the-mill manager.
No, and Brother Love was okay early on, but he wasn't going to go far with that.
No, no. You needed a guy that kind of went along with the whole package. And he made the Phenom. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest. Even my brother, who was at the 1990 Survivor Series and saw Taker for the first time, and again, the crowd didn't have that, ooh, he's a heel. It was more like, whoa,
right?
Who's this dude? And you're like, oh, all right, well, it's a nice gimmick. It'll, you know, last about a year, and then the guy will vanish and come back as something else. No, I think once he got Paul Bearer and the fans started to react to Paul Bearer and him, and then of course the feud at end of 91 with Hogan and the title wins and all that jazz, he made Taker. And I don't know if it would have been the same with him without him. So I think he deserves a lot of credit for making arguably the greatest gimmick in the history of the business. And very sad that he's no longer with us at the very young age of 58. He passed away last Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think it was on Raw.
Yeah,
no, it wasn't
Tuesday
on Raw.
Yeah, it was
because the end cap, they did one on Main Event, they did one on SmackDown, and then actually Pritchard said something on Impact Thursday night. So speaking of Brother Love. So easily number 10 on our list. Definitely top 10 guy.
I just want to give one quick moment.
Yep.
kind of under the radar, but one of my favorite Paul Bearer moments. Mm-hmm. And that is when he was with Jerry Lawler backstage. They didn't know the camera was on him. And it was right before Kane debuted, and when he was, you know, holding Undertaker hostage, and he talks about banging Taker's mom and everything. It is hilarious. Go dig it out on YouTube if you haven't seen it.
Yes.
I think it's like April or May 97. And they don't know the camera's on them. The camera's like on the ground, and they're sitting in the locker room. It's really funny. Him and Lawler do a great job with it. This was funny hearing him talk like that. So go check it out. Some great Paul Bearer work. And a guy that I wish we could have chatted with. I want to actually tell one other story. I received an email today from one of our faithful listeners, Mr. Toby Hope.
Yes.
If you know Toby, he's always tweeting at us. And he's actually a booker in a promotion in Chicago that worked.
That's right.
He's one of the last promotions that worked with Paul Bearer, William Moody, recently. So Toby tells me he had recently talked to Percy about coming on our show.
Really?
And the promotion is Pro Wrestling Blitz in Chicago. So he asked him, he said, I don't know if I should mention this to you, but as a fan of your show and loving your interviews with guys like JJ and Bruno, I mentioned to Percy about your podcast. He told me to email him so your info and links, and if he liked what he'd heard, he'd contact me to get a hold of you to come on the show. That was about a week before he passed away. So, Toby, we really appreciate you, you know, mentioning us and even considering us to chat with Bill Moody, and it's something I wish we could have done before he passed. That would have been an honor. So, you know, just kind of cool to even be considered for that.
Absolutely. That's very sad. Now it makes me really sad because it would have been nice to – because that's a guy that, again, no axe to grind, tell you any story you want. I mean, obviously, you know, within reason, you know, some things are best left untold. But I don't know how much of that would have been because the guy was just – he's been everywhere. And I would – he's the kind of guy I wouldn't really want to – I mean, it would be nice to talk about, you know, his relationship with Taker, but I'd rather more talk about his time at World Class and dealing with Fritz and the, you know, the Kerry and all these other guys and all of his guys he managed. I'd rather talk about that. I mean, I'd love to talk about Taker, but sadly, fate did not allow it. So it's unfortunate. Rest in peace, Paul Bearer. You will sorely be missed as a PTB all-time favorite. At number nine, it is kind of a late bloomer manager.
I think I should have my whistle out.
Yes.
Of course, the one and only Mr. Bill Alfonso, the premier manager in ECW, former WWF referee, went down there as a crooked referee in ECW, and they finally just turned him into a manager. He managed, of course, Taz, as Team Taz. Then he turned and aligned with Sabu and Rob Van Dam, and that's probably where he had his best run, was with those two when they were tag champions, and RVD became TV champ, and him and Sabu were fighting over the title. Fonzie was thought to be part of the problem as one of the moles leading to guys jumping to WCW. I believe it was proven that he was assisting Todd Gordon. And to pay his penance, he had a match with Beulah McGillicuddy where he almost bled to death. He lost a third of the blood in his body with the blade job he did, kind of won everyone back over, and ended up having a job for life with ECW. Returned to TNA recently, of course, with the whole ECW revamp. But Fonzie was great in ECW. You know, the whistle was infamous. He was great with Team Taz and just an annoying little prick. Did a great job as being just a heel dick.
And he's been, before managing, he was a referee in a lot of places. He refereed in Florida, refereed obviously in NWA, and refereed in WWF before being a manager. But and the match, you could find it. I think it's on one of the ECW DVDs, probably on the Bloodsport one. The match is only like 5.5 minutes long, but Beulah beats the fucking crap out of him. And yeah, by the end of the game, by the end of the match, I mean, there's probably brain matter on the ground. I mean, he'd lost. It was a mess. But you know what? I knew that Todd Gordon was the ultimate mole, but I didn't know that. I didn't realize Alfonso was siphoning for him. So I didn't know that. Yeah. So easily the premier manager in the history of ECW, because there really wasn't any others per se. So he's probably the standalone, standalone manager in the history of ECW. So number nine on our list, the highest rated ECW manager, and that is Bill Alfonso. At number eight.
I've been watching you from afar for as long as I can remember. You're all a real man can need and never ask for.
I truly thought I'd never hear it again.
Well, there it is.
So nice. At number nine, and you're wondering, that they were managers? Yes. The hell are you guys talking
managers
about?
Managers of your heart.
The managers of my heart, exactly. No, of course, number eight on our list of the PTB greatest managers of all time is Mr. Precious Paul Ellering, the manager of the Road Warriors.
Mr. Dotcom.
Kind of in the same vein as Mr. Perfect and almost Paul Bearer, is that he pretty much is known for managing pretty much one team or guy his entire career. When you manage the greatest, I know you don't agree, but one or two greatest tag teams of all time, you really don't need to manage anybody else. Obviously, he's from the AWA era. He's from Minnesota, so he was trained by Eddie Sharkey, who's one of Vern's boys, so he trained a lot of guys in the early AWA years. But obviously he injured, was his elbow? No, his knee. He was in Georgia, and he wrestled Robert Gibson, one half of the Rock and Roll Express, and injured his knee.
Mm-hmm.
So his wrestling career hit the pooper. But Ole Anderson, who was booking in Georgia, said, you know, guy cuts pretty good promos. I think he'd be good as a manager. And, of course, he managed the Road Warriors and managed them straight through from 1983 until 1997, except for the little stretch when they were in WWF the first time.
Right.
In 90, when they came in 90.
Right, then he showed up in 92.
Yeah.
He was with them until they left, and then he came back in 98, and, of course, he turned on them and hooked up with DOA, and I guess we'll forget that run. But, yeah, of course, his wheelhouse was the late 80s in the NWA, feuding with everyone and anyone, along with the Road Warriors, at all the War Games matches and the matches with a guy we'll talk about in a minute. So I always liked that they portrayed him as a smart guy. He was really a savvy guy, and if you heard the stories that he's told, he was really managing the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors, behind the scenes, too. He controlled all the bookings and made all the plans and managed the money, and so he lived that gimmick, whether he wanted to or not, he lived it. And I like that they portray that. He always had the Wall Street Journal and the sunglasses and spoke very concisely and clearly and was a really, really bright guy, and it came across that way.
Yes. Yeah. So number 8 on our list of PTB's greatest managers of all time, very high on my list, but not my favorite, Precious Paul Ellering, manager of the Road Warriors.
All right. Number 7, make our boys Chad and Parv very happy. Number 1, Paul Jones, checking
yes.
in.
Yes.
Well known in NWA, Jim Crockett. He won a couple titles along the way, and then he became a manager. Had Paul Jones' army. Boogie Woogie Man, Jimmy Valiant was his major feud. Ended up having his head shaved. Members of his army, the Masked Superstar, Rick Rude, Manny Fernandez, Shaska Watley, Baron Von Raschke, the Barbarian, Tejo Khan, the Mighty Wilbur, Abdul the Butcher, Superstar Billy Graham, Ivan Koloff, and Vladimir Petrov, and of course the Powers of Pain. Left Jim Crockett along about the time that Ted Turner bought it. Kind of worked the indies a little bit before closing up and opening his own body shop, which he still maintains today. Paul Jones, a guy I've gotten more of appreciation for when I started watching these WCWs on 24/7 from 87, 88. And I liked him with Billy Graham, a Barbarian. He had all the crazy hosses. And I'm not a big Jimmy Valiant fan, but I did enjoy this feud that kind of went on forever. But Paul Jones is just a quality. When you think of heel managers, this is a guy that pops in your head because he just fit the profile so well. This little smarmy, bowl-cutted idiot out there, just making his guys carry out his dirty work so he can take over the promotion. That was the basis of being a heel manager.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny. We finally found a guy that you and I both dislike, because I would never like Jimmy Valiant either.
Yeah.
And he always changed his look. Like, he would have no mustache and wear a tux, and then he would wear a mustache, and he would wear, like, fatigues, and then he would wear, like, that weird cowboy hat with the jacket. It was actually on in the event center a moment ago. That weird jacket with the big eagle on the back and, like, white red tights. He looked like a circus carnival master or some weird thing, but... His stable of guys, again, speak for themselves. Again, Abdullah, Superstar, Billy Graham, and Manny Fernandez, the short time he was a heel. My favorite guy, of course, always, Shaska Watley.
And to me, he reminds me of a guy on the level of like a Slick at the time in WWF. He didn't have any of the main guys, but he had, every now and then he'd have a brush with the main events, but mainly he just handled the upper to, mid-card, and he just had a wide array of guys that would... had dedicated feuds, but he was a believable manager, a great manager, just not a guy that carried the heel side of the promotion.
No, but a guy who obviously will be remembered as one of... He's like a Mid-Atlantic staple.
Right.
Like, that's a guy that you never forget. So number...
7.
7 on our list of PTB's greatest managers of all time. Number 1, Paul Jones. Number 6 on our list...
Your kiss is on my list.
It's just, oh, God. At number 6, a guy who, again, bounced around, but is very, very well known as one of the not only bookers, but managers, big-time managers in world class. And that is Mr. Gary Hart. He's from the Midwest. He was born in Chicago. He passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago at the age of 66. But he did make it onto not one, but both world class DVDs. The non-WWE one that came out in, 08 or something, and then the WWF one that came out a little bit after that. He managed all, the scary heels.
Yeah.
He managed Kabuki, managed Muda. He started pretty much – he's actually the one that booked the feud between the Von Erichs and the Freebirds. He pretty much told, because when the Freebirds came in World Class, they were baby faces. But I guess in a meeting, Gary Hart told Michael Hayes, you know, you guys be better off beating the shit out of these kids, and you'll get instant heat and instant cash. And that's what happened. And then, of course, the infamous Christmas Star Wars match where Terry Gordy slammed the door and the cage door in Von Erich's face against Ric Flair, and everything went from there. And that pretty much, that was Gary Hart's baby.
And don't forget, too, he had a great run in NWA in the early final days, right before, around when Turner was buying it, with when he was managing the JTEX Corporation. Terry Funk, yes. Dick Slater, Buzz Sawyer, the Dragon Master and Great Muta, feuding with Ric Flair and the Horsemen into early 1990. I love that name, JTEX.
Yes, I did too. He also managed, he came in 89 in NWA and actually managed Terry Funk during the feud with Flair after he did that awesome, after Flair pile drove, or Funk pile drove Flair after
right.
Flair
that's where it started, yep.
Yeah, beat Steamboat at Wrestle War. And then he managed Muta, and that was the whole Flair Sting Muta. And those matches in 89 were fucking awesome.
Yeah, that was
awesome.
The JTEX stuff mainly.
Yeah, that stuff was awesome. Yeah. Yeah, Muta's one of his more well known guys, but he also managed another guy managed Nord the Barbarian. Boy, John Nord got around, huh? Abdullah, another guy that managed by everybody. And then one of the greatest nicknames all time, next to Sweet Hansen, Jeep Swenson.
Oh, God.
When Gorilla used to call him the old sweeter. Hey, the sweeter's in the ring. Of course, he was 70 and like 900 pounds. But anyway, he also wrestled managed Bruiser Brody and all those usual. Yeah. Gary Hart was always the guy that managed like those promotion guys, you know, those territory guys.
Yeah, they come in for the run and he'd hook up with them.
Yeah, and Stan Hansen, those kind of guys, yeah. So Gary Hart's known for kind of bridging the territory gap in the 80s and managed some great guys. So definitely deserves to be high on the list. Number six. PTB's all-time managers, Gary Hart.
All right, now we're hitting the top five. This is pretty rarefied air. I don't think you could go wrong with any ranking of these five. To me, they were easily going to be here, and it's just a matter of the order we put them in, but I think you could argue differently as well. Number five, one of my all-time favorites. I'd probably have him almost as high as number two, and that is the one and only Mr. Paulie Dangerously / Paul Heyman. Mm-hmm. Of course, first became manager down in Alabama when he was also, started as a photographer. Worked his way up to NWA / WCW, and of course, started the fantastic, the awesome Dangerous Alliance.
Hell yeah.
Loved the Dangerous Alliance. That was when I first started watching WCW around that time. Managed, of course, Bobby Eaton, Rick Rude, Arn Anderson, Steve Austin, and Larry Zbysko, along with Medusa. What an awesome heel stable. Eaton, Rude, Anderson, Austin, Zbysko. That's like a dream heel faction. Dominated that 1 year of programming throughout 92. Culminating the awesome War Games match against Sting, Steamboat, Nikita Koloff, Dustin Rhodes. Just a fantastic, fantastic match. And that is, of course, where Bobby Eaton had his shoulder busted up and cost him the match and led to the dissolution of the Dangerous Alliance. Ended up jumping over to ECW, where he acted as a booker and on-screen talent along with Eddie Gilbert. Eventually would take over the promotion, turn it into Extreme out of Eastern. He was a good manager on and off there early on. Remember, he had 9-1-1 was his main charge during that time. Then he went behind the camera. But then you got to factor in his run in WWE in the 2000s. Managed Brock Lesnar. Had the quick run at the Big Show when he was world champion. Kurt Angle for a cup of coffee. Then he came back and, of course, now manages Brock Lesnar once again. So just a fantastic run. Just a Dangerous Alliance alone would have put him this high on the list. And then you factor in the two Brock runs and even the Big Show run has really solidified his role as one of the greatest managers of all time.
Yes, absolutely. And obviously one of the best promoters ever. Couldn't really balance a checkbook, but Johnny Reckless always calls him the mad scientist, and that's pretty much what he was.
Yeah.
But a great manager as well. So definitely number five on our list. And again, as JR mentioned, any of these five guys you can make your own case for in the order, but really there's these five guys are the top five. It's just the order is up to you. But we have him as at number five. At number four...
You have him at number five.
Oh, you have number five. At number four... again, another guy who you really can't argue about and countless champions. He had maybe one of the greatest years for a manager ever in 1987, but is one of the greatest of all time. And that is Mr. Jimmy Hart. Of course, came in. He's from Memphis, came in with Lawler.
And, he had such a great run in WWF His Memphis stuff was fantastic. That was a lot of stuff with Andy Kaufman. And, you know, one of my favorite specials of all time is that E1. I haven't seen that in forever. The one all about Andy Kaufman's run as a wrestler and a lot of stuff with Jimmy Hart in there. And this is an awesome, awesome feud he had there with Lawler. And then, of course, he jumped over to the WWF in 1985, hooked up with King Kong Bundy initially, and then picked up Greg Valentine. And from there, it was just took off the Hart Foundation. Like you said, 87 is dominated with them. Honky Tonk Man as the IC champion. And then you kind of take a back seat as the late 80s kind of came around, 88, 89, 90. Perked back up in 91 and 92 with Money Inc. and Earthquake. And then, of course, they finally turned face and hook up with Hulk Hogan after years of tormenting him. Jumped to WCW along with Hogan, would turn heel on him. And, of course, was a big player with the Dungeon of Doom before closing out with reuniting with Hogan at the end of the decade. So just an amazing run across three major promotions.
Yeah, and again, managed a myriad of champions. As you said, managed the Hart Foundation. They were tag team champions. Managed Honky when he was Intercontinental Champion. And managed the sexiest beasts in the face of the planet. And that was, of course, the Glamour Girls to the women's tag team title.
Beast is the right word. you know, it's funny because we keep talking about the coffin stuff. Unfortunately, I guess that was 1982, so it's kind of right on the periphery of what we're talking about. But the residual heat from 82 to 85 in Memphis carried him. And even without that run, he's still top five.
Yeah, I mean, he managed Bundy, Missing Link. He managed, obviously, Adorable Adrian Adonis during that whole feud.
Of course, Jimmy Hart, growing up, was part of the Gentrys.
That's right.
Their one hit song.
Their one hit song, Keep on Dancing, which hit the top five in 1965. There he is, number four.
Was that
on
your
our list.
Prom song?
No, my prom song was the War of 1812. No. Okay. Was Amadeus. No. Number four on our list of the place to be greatest managers of all time, Jimmy Hart. Number three, JR. Now we're really getting into
This is nitpicking at this point.
Yeah, this is these next three guys. I mean, make your own list, but this is what we have.
All right, number three, Mr. James E. Cornette, of course, started in the 80s in the NWA along with the Midnight Express, where he really was probably at his peak early on. Then he, of course, started his own promotion in Smoky Mountain, with the Heavenly Bodies, jumped to WWF in 1993, managed Yokozuna to the world title along with Mr. Fuji, Vader, Owen Hart, the British Bulldog, is Camp Cornette. Just an amazing run. Another guy like Jimmy Hart that hit all the major territories and had tons of success. Probably best known for the Midnight Express. He was just great in the mid-80s with all the stuff he did along with the Midnight Express against the Rock Roll Express and, of course, the scaffold matches and everything else. After some friction with the company, he went and started his own promotion. And from there, of course, hit the WWF. So Jim Cornette, very high in this list, very deservingly so. One of the greatest promos in wrestling history. A guy that still cuts a hell of a promo today. A little antiquated, probably, at this day. But a guy very set in his ways. A supporter of wrestling is the best way to probably describe him.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously butted heads with a lot of Attitude Era guys, most notably Vince Russo. But that's a different discussion for another day. As a manager, the guy is – he might be – the greatest tag team manager of all time. So I mean, every tag team he managed turned to gold, and he has the privilege of managing both the Midnight Express and you can argue and you mentioned that we've talked about it earlier in the show, JR, about who really was Yokozuna's manager. Mm. Was it Fuji or was it Cornette? Cornette was his American spokesman, but let's be honest, Cornette was siphoning the real heel heat for Yoko.
Oh, easily.
So, and of course, Camp Cornette. I can't say enough about how much they were one of my favorite WWF factions. Owen, Bulldog, he had all the good, but again, he had the faction of good wrestlers. You know, Owen and Bulldog, and obviously he had Vader, but just good wrestlers. He was the wrestling guy's manager, and a guy that you could never count out as one of the greatest of all time. Yes, he's very old school in his ways, but you know what? It doesn't hurt to have some of that right now in the business. So, number three on our list, greatest managers of all time. But again, people have him at two. Mm-hmm. Many people have him at number one, and that is Mr. Jim Cornette. All right. These next two guys are pretty much, I mean, let's be honest, they're one and 1A, or 1A and 1B, I guess. At number two, although again, you could you could probably call him these two guys in Cornette 1A, 1B, and 1C, and even go down with Jimmy Hart and Paulie Dangerously. But this guy goes in the same vein as Paul Bearer, Mr. Perfect, and Paul Ellering as pretty much great managers for managing one set of guys for a long period of time. And we, just like our man Downtown Bruno, we had the privilege of having him on our program. And that is, of course, number two on our list of the greatest managers of all time, Mr. James J. Dillon. Now, he managed Abdullah the Butcher. He managed the Mongolian Stomper. He managed Buddy Landell. Managed Ox Baker. Moondog Maine. The Long Riders, Ron Bass and Black Bart. But we obviously all know who truly he is the manager of managers for. And that was, of course, the Four Horsemen. What can you say? And what was great about him, and we obviously won't go long with this.
Right, we already have 5 hours with the J.J. Dillon.
Yeah, no, exactly, yes. Just listen to the podcast because it's awesome. And I meant to say this to him, and I might have somewhere in our deliberations with you, me, and Dr. G, is that he cut a good promo when he didn't even need to.
Right.
Look at the guys he was working with.
Yeah.
Ole, Arn, Tully, and Rick. Duh. you could just say nothing. And you can put guys over.
Yep.
But even Cornette, or Dillon, put in his extra 2 cents, and his promos were always awesome. Now, he managed, for those that wonder who the first guy he managed, and again, we'll talk more about it on the podcast, he actually managed Tully alone first.
Right.
And then kind of bled into
the Horseman.
Horseman with Arn and Ole. And
yeah,
Rick,
and so. A guy, like we said, short run on top, only really associated with one group, but had a hell of a run.
Yep.
And another guy that's just epitome of a heel manager. The look, the way he carried himself, the way he presented himself. And again, we'll direct you like we did for Downtown Bruno. We'll direct you to the podcast. We had two parts with JJ and almost 3 hours worth of content. So check that out when you go over his whole career and see why he ranks at number two. And Scott, that brings us to the cream of the crop, the top of the list, the greatest wrestling heel or manager of any level, heel, face, in wrestling history, according to the Place to Be podcast, and that is the one and only.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
Of course, you hear his voice, or us assimilating his voice, every week, every episode on the Place to Be podcast. That is the one and only Mr. Bobby the Brain Heenan.
How do you not? The guy spans, and you could do a two-parter. If we did two countdowns and did one pay-per-view era,
right,
he'd be in the top three.
Yeah, he had an awesome AWA run. 84, he jumped over to the WWF and immediately became a mega player. Hooked up with Big John Studd in his feud with Andre the Giant, Ken Patera, Paul Orndorff, King Kong Bundy, Andre the Giant, Brain Busters, Rick Rude, Harley Race, the Islanders, Hercules, Barbarian, the Mr. Perfect, Terry Taylor, and the Brooklyn Brawler. So, of course, Bobby Heenan. And he was also associated with Ric Flair. Remember, he's a financial advisor, too, so he gets some credit there. Of course, you know, best known maybe for commentator, but his heel manager run in the late 80s was just fantastic. He put everything into each of his guys, always working it at ringside, always, you know, he wasn't afraid to get the shit kicked out of him any time and place by any of the wrestlers. You know, he had the great feud, always trying to beat Hogan whenever he could, and, you know, never really quite got the job done, never managed a world champion, but he did have, of course, the IC champion, Rick Rude. Mm-hmm.
And the tag champs.
And the tag champs, the Brain Busters.
Of course, the awesome Brain Busters. Well, he never managed world champion. Let's clarify. Never managed the WWF world champion.
Right, yes. I meant in his feud with Hogan. He never
overcame
him.
Yeah, exactly.
But he had a great 89 with Rude and the Brain Busters. Probably his best year. And, an awesome, you know, awesome manager. Another guy that just epitomizes what it means to be a heel manager.
Yep. And, of course, and I think the emotional part of it for you and I and for wrestling fans is, just as much as he is a manager, he'll always be known as Gorilla's guy and the co-host of Primetime, the backbone of our childhood. Him and Gorilla on Primetime every Monday night. I mean, that's what you lived for. Just like I don't want to say live for Raw now, but I mean, every night during my last years of, you know, grammar school and high school, I lived for Primetime every Monday night because of Bobby and Gorilla.
Right. You know, we're not talking commentators, so we'll do that another time. But as a manager, there's always a guy that made everything, always put the little things in to make the story fit, to make everything work together. Always sold, always selling, had a quick wit, and like we said, wasn't afraid to get his ass kicked. So
and he was also an, uh, 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 stickler for detail.
Yes.
This guy needs his manager's license.
Yep.
That's the stuff we miss now. That's another debate. But yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. Absolutely.
All right, PTB Nation, there is your list, the PTB's list of the top 34 managers of all time. Let me re-clarify. Top wrestling managers since 1983, according to your PICs. Bobby Heenan tops the list, and we want you to go to the Bigelow34ProBoards.com message board and give us your list. You can rank these 34. You can add ones we missed. You can go any time frame, whatever you want to do. Generate some discussion. I'm sure this will bring up some hot debate. So, all right, Scott, I am about to tap out, so why don't we wrap up? That was a sprint and a marathon all in one, but it was a lot of fun. I had a good time ranking these. I missed the list of media. We'll have to come up with another topic soon.
Yes.
Thank you, Mike Brood, for coming up with this idea. Hope everyone enjoys it. We'll be back later this week. Where are we at? St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
St. Valentine's Day Massacre, yep. 1999. Speaking of Memphis, we'll be in Memphis.
Oh, yes. Yes, we will. Next week, we have an interesting week. Monday, we have our March Madness preview show, third annual. We'll have the crew of experts on.
Yep.
And next Wednesday, pick your big one. Pick your Vintage Vault. I'm going to close the thread up this week, so if you want to try and knock off the big event, you better get in there, but it's winning pretty handily right now. So as of right now, next Wednesday, we'll be reviewing the big event. So we'll talk to you this Wednesday, though, St. Valentine's Day Massacre. That is Scott. I am Justin. We'll talk to you later. Take care.
You know who we forgot on the list?
Your
Doc
face.
Holliday. Doc Holliday.
Doc Holliday would have been number one.
Sunclass Joe.
He wasn't a manager. He was an asshole.
A phony phone was the asshole.
No, Pony Phone's a fucking moron. That was a big one. So I said, hey, baby, spend the night at my house. She said,